Members, we have a quorum present. I will now call the committee to order. Members, in your packet are the minutes from the Friday, March 24th meeting. I think it was a fairly short meeting.
Yes.
Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Are there any questions, discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Abor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to take from the table House File 3237.
Representative Abor moves that House File
3237
be taken from the table. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just for members' advice, is a bleed all amendment, which is a task force.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. Representative Abor, would you make your way to the testifying table, please?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the can I move the bill first?
Representative Abor, I believe House File 3237 is before the committee.
Okay, and I think the direction would be to go to the floor, maybe the consent calendar if people are agreeable, but for now I'll move the DE1 amendment.
All right. Representative Abor moves the H3237DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion does prevail. To the read all amendments, Representative Abel.
Mr. Chair, what is that by me? If she would have known it was going to be this early, we're thinking it would be tonight, but there might not be it tonight, so we're going to do it now. And it's a deadline issue, so we'll still admit deadline. The matter before us used to be the discussion about splitting Elk River District into two, which, as you know, was controversial. You spent a fair amount of time, and this committee defeated that idea. After that meeting, I sat down with the superintendent and some other Elk River people, and for that, Elk River being the generic Elk River group, not really the Rogers group so much, but and to see if there's some way to remedy this matter. And in talking with the superintendent, who actually is an interim superintendent, who served, I believe, 30 years, then was gone 5 years, and has come back now as an interim role, I believe he is the man for the time to try to get some healthy activities going in that district. And in discussing with him, we crafted this idea of a task force. It's very permissive. There's not a penny of state money. The only thing the state's involved with is receiving a report, which will be presented next January on how it happened. The report may be in the form of another bill to split the district if it goes badly enough, but I would hope the report is that things are going better and the people are collaborating and children are being taught. And so what they will do is the superintendent will take it on himself as his major final act to convene, talk to the school board members. This bill and moving the bill will be the gun to the head of the school board district, which the Southerners think is unresponsive. And the Southerners are felt by the Northerners to be unreasonable. So by bringing the people together and talking, maybe it might help. So that's the whole point of this bill, Mr. Chair, and I'll stand for questions if anybody has any.
Are there any questions? Representative Carlson.
Chair, what's the role of the school board? As I read this, just about everybody's name, but the school board in terms of where participating or where the report would go?
They do report to the school board. They're reporting to the school board. And if you want to include school board members, that may have been an omission that somebody mentioned. So that would be a friendly amendment if you want to be sure they're listed. I don't want to leave them unlisted. So that's actually a good point, I think. Where would you want to, I think I'll add that just if you are cooperative with that. Where would you put them in the list?
Well, just
after superintendent?
That would probably be as good a place as any.
Representative Abor.
Mr. Chair, I'll move on 1.8 to after the superintendent to insert school board members.
Representative Abor moves on page 1, line 8, after superintendent, insert school board members, comma.
And Mr. Chair, it's our intention to include everybody possible up there, so that's just a technical oversight, so I appreciate that.
Representative Abler, would you incorporate that amendment? Representative Abler incorporates that amendment. Are there any other questions? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, is it your intention that, as this reading, must convene a voluntary local task force? The superintendent must convene a voluntary local task force. Does that mean the superintendent must convene a task force made up of people who come voluntarily? Or is he convening a task force of people who will be volunteers and he's appointing them?
Representative Abler.
Yes.
I that think was
the point of this. This is a coalition of the willing, and the people will come. That's the point of it. He's not going to. I think the what's been. And maybe the word voluntary is just to emphasize the fact that this is a way to work out things amiably. And so he is a man who will be deciding because of his stature. Perhaps iconic stature in that world, and will draw people to come in. And so if people come, then they can have a voice. If they don't, then they should have come, I guess, is the point of it. So if that's clear enough, that's...
Yes. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm not clear about, Representative Abler, is if anybody can come, or is the superintendent appointing the members and then telling them they're volunteers?
Representative Abler.
I believe they're going to work on an anybody-can-come basis. But he may appoint leaders of things. They'll have community meetings. And I'm not sure if they're clear how they're going to actually set it up. I think we're going to give them a great deal of flexibility. If you think that's unclear and he'll have trouble with it, I'm willing to amend it. But it's his task force. He's going to do what he wants with it. There's no per diems. No one's getting paid. That's the voluntary part. So don't look for a check for your time in the meetings and don't look for mileage. That's the voluntary nature of it in particular. And I think he'll set up many subcommittees in this task. It'll be a community process for once is the point of it.
Representative Stanley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you know, I don't have a dog in this fight, Representative Abler. I'm just a bystander looking at this. But another concern, I guess, that if I was looking at this objectively, is there plenty of room for everybody throughout the district as you've turned northerners and southerners to both be included? I don't see anything that says where they have to come from. So I think the intent would be is from throughout the entire school district, and I guess if you're comfortable with the language to make sure that everybody feels they're going to be included in this, I'd be okay with that. But I think that would be an intent to make sure that throughout the district there are people there. And that's what I was getting to through the appointment process. If the administration and or school board has a certain bias, should we say, and if they're appointing the members, the outcome could be... hypothesizes what that might be, let's just say. Oh. So I guess the intent I'm thinking, Representative Abler, is that these would be from throughout the whole school district and they would have conversation.
Representative Abler.
And in the draft, I thought there were geographic was there. I don't think it shows up in this final one. I set them up to work with staff. I'll tell you, if they don't do it like that, you'll have the same bill next year. And so that's the intent, is to head off this up again.
Representative Garland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, were you a middle child?
No, I was the oldest.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garland, I was the oldest.
Representative Dorn. Representative John Dorn.
Mr. Chair and members, a thought occurred to me listening to the discussion between Representative Demmer and Representative Abler perhaps it would clarify if on line 1.7 we deleted voluntary and then on 1.11 inserted to voluntarily examine. Just moving the emphasis would have the superintendent convening the task force and then they would voluntarily examine. That might clarify. And I'd certainly would be open, but those thoughts occur to me, Mr. Chairman, when I listen real carefully and with my left ear. So.
Representative Thorn moves that on page 1, line 7, to strike the word voluntary, and on page 1, line 11, to insert after exam, or before examine, the word voluntarily. Representative Abler to the amendment.
I'll incorporate that.
Representative Abler incorporates that amendment. Are there any other questions? Representative Abler, I do have an oral amendment I'd like you to consider. This from staff, but it is always good form to expire any task force. And so what I would like to do is on page offer on page 1, line 18, to add the sentence, the local task force expires on September 2nd, 2006. Representative Abor.
I'll call that a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair, and incorporate it.
All right. So incorporated. Are there any further questions to the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, is the motion for consent calendar appropriate? Maybe ask for objections.
Any? Would there be any objections from members of this committee to move this through the consent calendar? Seeing none, your motion so amended, Representative Abor. Representative Abor moves that House File 3237, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Right away. Okay. Members, the next bill on our agenda is House File 3411, Representative Demmer.
Representative Dermer.
Thank you, Representative Chair Dean. I would like to move House File 3411 for a re-referral to the Committee on K-12 Education Finance.
Representative Dermer.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill is reestablishing some incentive that we've had in the past for national board certification for teachers. In my research, back in 1997 through 2001, we had a program here in the state of Minnesota that gave some incentive and paid some incentives to individual teachers to pursue national board certification. National board certification came about from back in 1987. The National Board of Professional Teaching Standards came about back in 1987 as a result of a report called The Nation Prepared, Teachers for the 21st Century. The National Board of Professional Teaching Standards was an attempt to elevate the teaching profession by not just educating teachers with knowledge and in content, but also in the practice of teaching and how they teach. It concentrates reform in the classroom where the actual teaching and learning take place. National Board Certification is a demonstration of a teacher's practice as measured against high standards. Their certification is valid for 10 years. At that time, they have a rigorous reevaluation and process to go through to become recertified. If a teacher wants to become National Board certified, it costs about $2,500. Members, the reason I took this on, this is not just another attend a class and get a certificate type of a program. It's very impressive. Through the years, currently in Minnesota, we have about 276 teachers total that are National Board certified. On any given year between 1994, there was one teacher that became certified. The high number of teachers since that time has been 50 were certified in the year 2001. Each year there have been there's been less than 100 teachers that have applied in each of the years since that time, and roughly 50% end up becoming certified. between 26 and 50% make it their first time when they take the test and take the evaluation. And the second time, the people who don't make it try again. And even after two or three times, there's been about ranging from 53 to 56, 45%, 32% 1 year of teachers actually get certified. Mr. Chair and members, this is not a slam dunk thing. This is a big commitment, and it can take up to 3 years for a teacher to get this certification. At this time, Mr. Chair, you have a copy of the bill in front of you. I do have an amendment. Is that in the packet?
Sure. Is that the A06-1366?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to amend that to get it in the shape that you'd like?
Yes, I would.
Does everyone have that? Representative Demmer moves the A06 amendment. All those in favor of accepting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what the amendment does, and in your packet, or you got a packet here from, it's a blue folder from Education Minnesota that does detail some specifics on what this may look like. The specific parameters, I think it's a pink sheet in there, talks about some awards that might be granted and that sort of thing. What I did, and that's patterned after what the program was, I think, that existed between 97 and 2001. What I did to make this a little more clear for fiscal purposes as well as to give an opportunity to maybe reshape the program into something maybe more user-friendly, maybe more advantageous, is allocated, and this gets into the finance part, but we'll talk about that in finance when we get there. But basically what it does is it says the commissioner in consultation with National Board Certified Teachers and Administrators will get together and talk about how to utilize this money to set up an incentive program to go down this road. That's the intent of this amendment, Mr. Chair and members, and what the bill now stands. So with that, I will I'll quit talking and turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Chair.
We have Lynette Wayne.
Good morning.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Lynette Wayne, and I'm a National Board Certified Teacher from Hastings, and I currently teach first grade. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we are so pleased to be here today to share our passion and enthusiasm for National Board Certification. We strongly believe that this certification and the proposed legislation will promote quality teaching for Minnesota's children, and we certainly appreciate the time you're giving us this morning. And we want to personally thank Representative Demmer for supporting our efforts. The mission of National Board is not just to certify teachers, but to strengthen the teaching profession. And it pushes us to think deeply about our practice so that we will better understand what we do well and, more importantly, how we can improve to better serve students. National Board is designed to identify, recognize, and reward teachers who meet the highest standards of our profession. It's a very rigorous process, which requires us to critically examine what we do in the classroom and the impact it has on students. And through the process, we go through an extensive series of performance-based assessments, which include teaching portfolios, work samples, videos, DVDs, and it requires a thorough analysis of our teaching practice. Teachers must submit value-added data, and this means we must compile several samples of students' work from different points in the school year, and we must explain how we assess this work and develop interventions and document how students improve. So the value of National Board can be found in as much in the process as the outcome. Over the last few years, there's also been research now that has identified the links between the quality of teachers and the achievement of students. And National Board certified teachers do produce great student achievement gains. And now there is the research, and I think in your packet there is a yellow sheet that shows some of the research that has been done to support this. National Board is supported by a wide range of stakeholders in education, including school board members, administrators, teachers, and parents. The business community has provided overwhelming support for National Board, and a few of those businesses have been the Business Roundtable, the National Association of Manufacturers, and the Chamber of Commerce. They've all been very supportive. Right now, more than 47,000 teachers across this country have achieved National Board certification, and in Minnesota, 276. Personally, it was the strongest, most challenging professional development experience I've had in my 27 years of teaching. What it did was it truly allowed me to put my practice under a microscope and hold it up against high national standards. And although I attained my certification in the year 2000, it's something that stays with me. I continually assess what I'm doing with my first graders, what I need to improve upon, and what I need to do for those students. It's something that I think you will find common among National Board Certified teachers. It's a process that stays with you, and you are changed as a teacher. This legislation has three components which we hope will be achieved through this legislation. One is help with fees because it is expensive. Two is candidate support, and candidate support not only helps teachers achieve certification, it also helps candidates stay involved in the process, and a modest grant after receiving recognition. Our neighboring states of Wisconsin and Iowa have great incentives for their national board teachers. Wisconsin will reimburse up to $2,000 for the fees and give an annual stipend of $2,500 for the life of the certificate. Iowa gives $1,150 to begin with and another $1,150 after completion for the fees, and it also gives an annual stipend of $2,500. As National Board Certified Teachers, we truly do not claim to be the best teachers in Minnesota, but we do want to be the best teachers for the students we are with each and every day. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lane. Next up, we have Dan Allswiger and Sandy Hayes. Ms. Hayes.
My name is Sandy Hayes. I've spent 34 years in eighth grade, including my own eighth grade year, as a teacher in Becker. In Every Child a Graduate, a framework for an excellent education for all middle school and high school students, the Alliance for Excellent Education has noted that there is compelling research that indicates that teacher quality is the single most important school variable affecting student achievement. A growing number of researchers are finding that teacher characteristics have a greater impact on student achievement gains than any other variable. Gains that are needed to close the achievement gap. For these reasons, the Alliance includes support for increasing the number of National Board Certified Teachers as one of its four recommendations for its Teacher Quality Initiative. While I feel is the most common sense yet underappreciated benefit of National Board Certification is the emphasis on self-reflection. So many improvements initiatives are focused on student test scores and on using prepackaged standardized pedagogy, treating students like a chemistry equation or a cooking recipe. Learning has too many variables for a formula or a simple recipe, and that's where teacher reflection plays a critical role. Researchers have found that teachers make more than between 800 and 1,500 classroom decisions a day. Self-reflection is essential in making more effective decisions. It is the emphasis on teacher reflection that St. Peter's School Superintendent Dr. Jeffrey Olson feels is so attractive about national certification. He was unable to attend this hearing, but was enthusiastic about sharing what his district is doing. Last week, 13 St. Peter teachers, including Dr. Olson's wife, a fifth grade teacher, packed up and mailed their portfolios of classroom activities and reflections on the student learning they represent. These portfolios demonstrate ways in which their instruction meets content-specific standards and is tailored for the unique developmental stage of their students. Most importantly, these portfolios reflect what teachers have learned about their own effectiveness, their awareness that accomplished teaching is a continuous journey, not a destination. Not only did these St. Peter teachers feel the triumph and relief that both Lynette and I have felt upon the completion of this rigorous and intense stage of the process, but they've also experienced the building of a professional learning community as the St. Peter district coordinated extensive support for the candidates in a unique collaboration with Mankato State University and Augustana College. The St. Peter candidates expressed the most universal endorsement of all candidates in the 11-year history of the certificate, that it is the best professional and personal development activity they have ever experienced, and this is a process that helps good teachers become better. Dr. Olson's leadership has also set a realistic expectation for the candidates that the overwhelming value is going through the process and not gaining the certification. He also endorses that it may be a three-year process for a candidate. St. Peter expects to sponsor another cohort in 2007. Learning from the experiences of the first cohort, the teachers who have expressed an interest in forming the next group would like to spend a preparatory year gearing up for the intensity of the candidacy year. As the first National Board certified teacher and therefore also the first to complete the renewal process, I've had to go it alone, and I envy the cohorts. The learning community and university collaborations of the St. Peter teachers and of other districts that have sponsored similar ventures that deepen an already challenging experience. In greater Minnesota, these opportunities are harder to come by. Small districts may have a difficult time in reaching a critical mass for a cohort and have fewer resources to support candidates. In many cases, distances to a university make collaboration difficult. To give teachers in greater Minnesota access to this professional opportunity, the provisions for candidate supports in this bill are especially meaningful to me. I know that I am a better teacher for having gone through this process. I respect data-driven decisions, but I am committed to collect other kinds of data than just test scores as evidence of my students' growth. Last year, my 96 eighth graders read an average of 15.9 books as part of their coursework, which is 1,528 books. I've collected samples of their work, and best of all, samples of their own self-reflection, in which most have expressed satisfaction and even surprise at their growth and achievement. In fact, many students comment that they're surprised that they were able to read as much as they were. Because I have modeled high expectations for myself, I am more confident in having these high expectations for my students. Because I have measured my practice against standards created by leaders in my field, English, I am reassured that even in the isolation of my classroom, I'm on the right track in helping all my students, gifted, ESL, struggling readers, competent readers, illiterate readers, succeed in challenging literacy tasks, not just in the traditional literacy skills, but also in the digital literacy and media literacy skills they will need in the world of their future. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hayes. Ms. Halswiger?
I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chan Allsweiger, Education Minnesota, and I must say that it is a pleasure to sit here with Representative Demmer and give wholehearted support to his bill, and we look forward to more collaborations in the future. Education Minnesota strongly supports this bill and the efforts of these National Board certified teachers. You know, we heard a bill the other day about extra days in a school year, and it was calculated at, I believe, $27 million per day. Representative Demmer is proposing $750,000 to have a huge impact on, we don't know yet the number of teachers, but this will in turn then affect hundreds of students, and this is a great payback for what you'd be getting for your investment. When you listen to National Board certified teachers and they talk about teaching, it is infectious. And when they go back into their school building after doing these activities, they start talking about what they have learned about examining their own teaching. And it spreads to other teachers as well. National Board certification also develops school leaders and inside the classroom and outside the classroom. And if you haven't taken a look at this yellow document on the right side of your folder, I really encourage you to examine this research. This is amazing information. They have been now studying National Board for a number of years, and now that it's been in place, they're starting to get some really good data. And they've done 18 research studies spending $6 million on the research, and many of these are going to be completed very soon. Just to highlight some of what they have said, the Miami-Dade math teachers who received National Board certification, their students achieve larger testing gains than colleagues who did not earn certification, and they were especially effective with special needs kids, those who are Black and Hispanic. On average, students of National Board certified teachers scored as if they had received, get this, more than 1 month's worth of additional instruction. So I won't go through all of this research, but this is amazing. And when you consider the amount of investment, I think this is one of the most effective things that you can do to start working on closing the achievement gap. And we would certainly appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Allswiger. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Sir, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Jerome Joseph Tower.
Please proceed, Mr. Tower.
I used to be part of this organization at this Capitol. There used to be a page, like some of the people that run bills along this place. And I'm watching as I have experience at this, actually 3 to 4 years, because before I worked for the state, I worked for FEMA. We did field test experiments. So I have knowledge of government, so I'm not lying. So as I sit in front of all these people of importance, I watch, as a page, I watched senators and representatives talk on the internet without even listening to a bill or a word that anybody had to say. And the jewels, it's funny to me that I look at the jewels of these people who are supposed to be of importance on this planet. Listen to this. It's sickening to me.
Power, could you please address the bill, please?
I agree with the bill completely. And the only thing that will save anything on this planet will be education. That's the only thing that will save this country from welfare and a whole bunch of other things. But is this, for the record, is this being recorded?
Yes, it is, sir.
All right. Who's the chair of this committee?
Right now it's me.
Right. It's yours. It's funny. I'm pretty sure it's recorded. I watched you jeer and not pay attention to what she was saying while she was speaking. You know, it's disgusting to me. It's people like you. You can watch YouTube talk while she was speaking. And if you have two cameras on this, it's very, very disturbing to me as a taxpaying American.
We'll continue. You're not addressing the bill. We're going to move on with discussion.
You're right,
sir.
You're right. For the record, I chose the Ways and Means Committee because that's the most powerful one. Did you know I worked here in 1999 and I watched a general in 1999 turn its.
Sir, I'm gonna have to ask you to
Mr. Tower, to you, Chairman.
Sir, Mr. Tower, I'm gonna have to ask you to please end your testimony. We're gonna move on with discussion of the bill.
Fair enough.
Thank you, sir. Discussion of the bill. We have Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, to Ms. Allswiger, if you could please.
Very good to see you, Ms. Allswiger.
Great to be back, Mr. Chair. One surprise.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Allswiger, I just, for my understanding, is it the general rule in the state of Minnesota that National Board certified teachers actually have an increase or a stipend in their pay ongoing? Does that happen, and if so, is it an exception or the rule?
Ms. Allswiger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the question that you're asking is, to clarify, is you're wondering if the teacher contract allows for additional pay because of National Board certification. And that can be a locally bargained item. And out of the 341 approximately school districts in the state, we did some research because we thought you might ask this question. And we believe that there are approximately 46 contracts that have some additional compensation or a stipend. One thing about this that is an opportunity for rural Minnesota is they don't always have the access to the higher education component, and so this is something that they can do independently and that can help them. The stipends generally are fairly minimal.
Thank you. Representative Business.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at Subdivision 4, the award proceeds. And you can receive a grant for partial payment of the teacher's candidate application. And my question, I think, is of the author. It's been a number of years since I was on the tax committee, but sometimes there's a difference when you start talking in terms of tax liability between a grant and reimbursement. And one of the testifiers, I forget which one, mentioned Wisconsin and used the word reimbursement. And my only point is you may want to run that by one of the staff people for the tax committee, at least, to see if the word grant in partial payment might serve the applicant better if it were to reference reimbursement. And I, like I say, it's been a lot of years since I've been there, but maybe you know now, but I assume the goal would be a reimbursement that would then not be taxable.
Representative Demmer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, actually, we amended that part of the bill. The amendment deals with basically just appropriates the money and says that the commissioner and the administrators and some certified teachers would put together a program and they would determine whether it's reimbursement grant, how much goes to where. So we struck that last part that dealt with the appropriation and changed it just to basically allow them with a block of money to put together whatever kind of facilitation they wanted, whatever sorts of awards they wanted, that sort of thing, so they could deal with that at that time.
Thank you.
Representative Sikora.
Yes, this is kind of a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on Representative Biskin's question. I was curious, of the districts that do have teachers who have gone through this process, are the teachers in Minnesota kind of clustered in a handful of districts, or how generally how is that working, kind of a school district initiative?
From the information that I have, mainly, most of our National Board Certified teachers are from the metro area at this point. And I think part of the reason for that is back when we had the state incentives from 1997 to 2001, and we had regional coordinators that helped, Minneapolis and St. Paul had larger numbers going through and also pulled in from the metro area. We are seeing more interest in greater Minnesota, but I think because it is an expensive process and there's not much within their contracts, and there's not as much support, we don't have as many in greater Minnesota. And that's part of our reason for wanting state incentives to pull in teachers from across the whole state. Thank you.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've all said everything I agree with. I basically say amen, but because I've seen this process up close. I didn't take part in it because the time commitment was enormous, and I had drill weekends and coaching and all that. There's no way I could have done this. But one question, isn't this license good across the country? To whoever can answer it. I mean, you can go to another state, and this is good in that state also. That's what I was told one time.
National Board is recognized across the country as a National Board certification as far as portability. It doesn't necessarily replace a license that a state would require. So if I were to go to another state, my certification would be recognized as that, but wouldn't necessarily allow me to be licensed in that state without looking at their state licensing procedures.
Some states, though, do waive the additional requirements. Each state has some unique requirements for teacher license, and some states waive that for National Board Certified teachers, but they do have to have a valid license in the state in which they're coming from.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know which one of you can answer this, but what do other states? Are there a lot of other states who give support for National Board Certified teachers or for the process?
Just like there is in the local districts in Minnesota, there's great variation across the country. Some of it has to do with which are collective bargaining states and which aren't. Those that are not collective bargaining have much higher incentives. In fact, North Carolina's at one point was, I think, $10,000 a year. So there's, between that and nothing, there's a huge range. But I think the $2,500 a year stipend, as far as I know, all of them are for the life of the certificate, so it's not a legacy that you don't have it forever, but just as long as you maintain the certification. Some provide the candidate support. Some provide reimbursement for the expense. Some provide, I think there are even states that provide access to equipment, but certainly there are locals that provide that too. So some things are intangible that are also offered as incentives.
Thank you. Further discussion to the bill? Representative Rude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. You maybe said this when we were having the sidebar discussion here. You go through the initial certification process, and then to maintain the certification, do you have to do continuing ed credits or things like that, or what's involved in that?
To maintain, which I've done, I'm right now the only teacher in Minnesota whose certificate expired, so I had to renew. And if you do not attain the renewal within the 10-year window, you have to start over again. So they really value maintaining your credentials. And the renewal process really is a wonderful one. It's not tailored the way the initial certification is to content area and age of student. It's a more of a generic process in order to keep the cost down, but it also is a much better process for the next stage, and that's you choose the areas in which you want to examine. You choose four areas from the last 10 years in which you believe that your practice has improved, and you demonstrate with artifacts and videotape and discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hayes.
That also carries a cost, and that's, I believe, $1,150 to do the renewal piece.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Demmer renews his motion to pass House File 3411 as amended, and it be referred to K-12 Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'd like to move House File 3326, recommended to pass, and re-refer to the Committee on K-12 Finance, and I also have an amendment.
Thank you, Representative. To your amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move H3326A1.
Representative Erickson moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment?
Mr. Chair and Committee, I brought forth this amendment because the ag educators have asked me to do so. They happen to be an area of licensure that's being threatened by downsizing, by changes in the use of vocational within our school systems, and would very much like to have this kind of opportunity. So I have specifically included them in the amendment to clarify.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Thank
to the
you,
bill,
Mr. Chair,
as amended.
This is another opportunity for the Board of Teaching to grant qualified teachers licensure through passage of the Praxis Content Exam. And the bill, I think, is pretty complete in itself. The language is found on page 3. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions. I do want the committee to know that I've heard from numerous teachers. Once these bills are introduced, I hear, of course, from ag educators, but many others, like Bernadette, who is having a terrible struggle in her school district because she has been teaching in a department that has downsized and wishes to teach in another subject area. And the University of Minnesota is telling her that it will take her 3 years to convert to another subject area. She doesn't have the money, nor does she have the time to do that. And she is teaching on a waiver presently, and she would like to be among the highly qualified. Pam is another example of someone who taught social studies and because of declining enrollment in her district, has the opportunity to teach in another subject area, language arts. She would like to be able to do that in a reasonable time period and is willing to take the praxis. Or there is Mark, who is also teaching in a subject area in his school district in which declining enrollment has affected. And there are others, especially in our rural schools. And, Mr. Chair, I do have some testifiers, so maybe we'll wait with the questions and hear from them. And maybe we should start with Mr. Allen from the Oakland Alternative.
If Mr. Allen could come to the testifying table. Mr. Allen, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Allen. I'm with Oakland Area Learning Center, and I'm president-elect of Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. I'm here to testify in support of Representative Erickson's bill that will help teachers attain additional licensure. There are many parts of Nickleby that are negatively affecting schools, but in particular, the section regarding the defining and the use of highly qualified teachers. I don't think I need to tell you how this federal legislation limits and restricts small programs. It is and will continue to have detrimental effects on alternative programs, care and treatment programs, charter schools, and rural schools. From the very beginning, we have worked, and I tried to work with the department in trying to find reform to this process. We've worked with the department and the Board of Teaching for about the last 3 years. We have put together some very creative initiatives that have been stalled or put on the back burner. Two of these initiatives were the teacher of record model and the creation of an interdisciplinary teaching license. The department has created a house process that provides some relief, but this will not help enough. Beginning July 1st of this year, there will be hundreds of teachers impacted by this legislation. Representative Erickson's bill will provide us just another tool that helps assist teachers and programs. In Minnesota, teachers currently need to do three things to attain a teaching license. Number one, they need to have a bachelor's degree. Number two, they need to complete an approved college preparatory program. And number three, they need to pass a teacher licensure examination. Excuse me. By allowing certified teachers to be able to take an additional practice examination in another content area, we provide an opportunity for diversifying our competent teachers. In closing, I would like to encourage you to give strong consideration for Representative Erickson's bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to say that I worked for Mr. Allen for a number of years in Oakland, and though I taught only in English or language arts, I had colleagues, you know, who were on waivers, who were on variances, who were teaching in the ALC itself, who even talked to me then, before I was an elected official, about how they could have integrity in their subject area in which they're teaching. So for the ALCs, this is another tool, as Mr. Allen said. Now, next, we have the superintendent from Sleepy Eye. He represents a small and rural school district and has been with us before. We welcome him back.
Mr. Haugen, please state your name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Jay Haugen, Superintendent of Sleepy Eye Public Schools.
Thank you. Proceed.
For me, this is a rather simple thing to be in support of. As a superintendent of a small school that tries to offer everything that any school anywhere can offer for its kids, because I think they deserve it, we need lots of, well, tools is the word they use. We need some flexibility. We need to have the opportunity to make our decisions and have some local control over those things. And this is just one of those things that would be very good for my small school. There are many times when we try to offer a course, maybe an advanced placement course or a college course or something new, where we just don't have a person on staff to do that and to hire maybe the replacement course or something to get get someone hired who's certified to teach one course as an ongoing program, you know, just isn't going to happen. It's for us often whether or not we offer the course, whether or not we offer an opportunity to a student. So for us, it's a big deal. One of the things that worked very well for us, that for instance, we have a music teacher who luckily, more than 20 years ago, loved English and ended up getting her major in English too. So whenever we have a need for one more English class, we're able to stick her in and do that. Even though she hadn't taught that in over 20 years, we gave her a summer to prepare, told her it was coming, she took some classes and was able to do it. That worked for us. It just may well have been, though the stars hadn't aligned, she had the same passion of English, the same knowledge of English, but was unable to, because he didn't have the certification, to teach that. And she was not going to go, you know, we're an hour from university. She was not going to go for the time. I don't know what they would have accepted more. I'm saying it's 20 years ago. I'm not telling you how old she is. I'm not sure they would have ever, she would ever been able to climb that mountain to get that certification. It never wouldn't have been anything but a waiver. But now, years later, she is a fabulous teacher in that one class when we need it from her. I'll tell you one more story. It's me. First time I've ever had to testify about me. I'm a science teacher. I was a science teacher way back when. We don't have a physics teacher on staff. I have stepped forward to teach physics. Yeah. On variance. I actually will tell you that I found out I loved physics at the end of my college career. When I was in graduate school, I put myself through a year of graduate school by writing a full year physics course that ended up being in marketed to an independent study place in many, many states. I really got to know physics. I am nowhere near getting a degree in physics. And so if I was to continue, again, supporting my school, being able to take a physics exam and show that I have great subject knowledge of physics would really help me in my school. Right now, we're having students take physics online. We get very few kids who are going to make that commitment or are able to make that commitment and really do a good job of physics online. That's just another thing that an opportunity my school would have through a bill like this. Again, for me, it's a rather simple thing. It's about local control. We have 10 superintendents who meet in my area. I think we all would have reasons to make use of this bill. I think, again, it really for me comes down to whether or not I can offer an opportunity for my students in my school. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Halligan.
I believe Jean Piccolo from Charter Schools would like to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. We support the concept found in this bill, as it would provide already licensed teachers with additional licenses through the demonstration of competence through the Praxis 2 examination for that particular discipline. We believe that this is a way, a tool, to address the need for qualified teachers in some discipline areas of study where there's shortages, and also in some geographic areas of the state, especially with small and rural schools. We believe that the focus should be on providing young people opportunities with qualified teachers, and therefore we support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I believe that Sherry Schoenfelder, who represents Ag Educators, has returned from the Senate, and if he'd like to testify, we'd like to hear from him.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Could you please state your name for the committee? For the
record?
Adam Walker, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work for the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Agricultural education is taught in about 190 schools in this state, and we have got quite a background in science in particular. We worked with the University of Minnesota for a number of years developing curriculum in animal science, plant science, and environmental science. It is taught in a lot of our schools, and in many of the local schools they do use it as a science requirement to fulfill the science requirement. It is also allowed to be used as an entrance requirement to fill the science requirement at the University of Minnesota. The background for agricultural educators is steeped very soundly in science, and that probably is the area that we would be most useful with regard to this bill. We would support it fully and would hope that the committee would do so as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Heigerken, you have a question for
the thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schoenfield, just that you've got an ag major, what are some of the courses you were required to take that would, you know, better enlighten the committee where an ag teacher is at when it comes to science?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heigerken, I have to say I do have a degree in agricultural education, but I first entered the legislature in 1980, so it's been a while since I've taught there. But I can tell you, at least with regard to my own background, what we took at that time, and I know that the standards are pretty much similar. For instance, when I was an undergraduate, I took three courses in inorganic chemistry. I took a course in organic chemistry. I took introductory biology, botany, zoology, plant pathology, microbiology, and genetics, physics. So fairly steeped in science all the way across to, I guess, you know, from the University of Minnesota. We always look at people like Norman Borlaug that won Nobel Peace Prizes because of the fact that they were agricultural scientists. So,
thank you.
A follow-up from Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schoenfeld, do you believe that the praxis exam would be sufficient in testing an applicant to those courses that you listed, and you'd feel confident that a person who passes one of those content area exams has the necessary knowledge and information to teach in that discipline area?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I personally do not have all that experience, but I will tell you that I've talked to our president of our Association of Ag Educators, who helped to develop the praxis exam, was on the committee that helped to develop it, and he's very confident that this is a good direction.
Representative Sikora, did you have a question for this witness?
I have a question for one of these folks. I'm not sure which one can answer it.
I think what we'll do is we'll finish testimony first and come back to you.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Sikora. Do we have further testifiers to the bill?
To support, I'm not sure you might want to ask the question if there are others. I'm sure there's opposition.
Are there others who wish to testify in support of this bill? Then we'll take testimony for those who oppose the bill. We have Jan Alzweiger, who wishes to testify against this bill. I, too, am happy to see you, Ms. Alzweiger.
There's so much love here today.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is a lot of love here today, and I'm happy that you're happy to see me. And I hope Representative Erickson is happy to see me, too.
Yeah. Go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alzweiger, Education in Minnesota. And all of this sounds very logical, and I think what Representative Erickson is trying to do is deal with a teacher shortage in some areas, and we understand that. However, we feel that, as I've stated before, it's very important to keep the level of quality that is maintained by the Board of Teaching. And when we take a test and have someone possibly get another teaching license because of a test, we feel it doesn't demonstrate the competencies necessary to teach that content area. I might, as an elementary licensed teacher, I might know another content area very well, but it doesn't mean that I know how to teach that subject because of the difference in ages, the difference in the practice of teaching. You heard these individuals here testify before about the practice of teaching. They were talking about how you teach kids. And they take that National Board certification in particular areas so they can learn the practice of teaching in those areas. So we feel this is actually going in the opposite direction. And we would encourage you to ask this question again. Who do you want, and what kind of qualifications do you want the people that teach your kids? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Elsweger. Representative Biskins? No. Representative Wardlow, do you have a question for this witness?
I think so.
Well, I think you may go ahead and ask a question.
Okay. When I was working on my master's in mathematics, because my first degree was in physical education, and when I came back from the Marine Corps, I decided I want to get a job, so I switched to math at that time. And I continued on to get my master's, and one of the best professors I ever had, the chair of the math department at Mankato State, it was called at that time, Dr. Turner, said someone had asked him one time, and this is a PhD in mathematics, and said, somebody asked me once, what do you know about trigonometry? And he said, nothing, I haven't taught that course yet. And the summer I got my master's, the Marine Corps asked me to come back and teach mathematics to college prep people that they were going to send off through Kennedy School and send them to school first. And these guys were like had a couple years of college. They're pretty bright people, and I had to teach. I have never taken trig in my life. I discovered I kind of needed it when I was going through calculus, but so I kind of self-taught that for myself, you know. But all of a sudden, I found myself teaching trigonometry. And I discovered what my professor had said was absolutely true. Having taken the test is no guarantee you know the subject. And if you're in the field of, say, science, as the former testifier said, I taught physics and found out I liked it. I don't know. I think this bill has lots of merit. And Ms. Allswiger, you and I agree on it many times, I know, but I'd like you to comment, maybe.
Ms. Allswiger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wardlow, you know, I think as individuals we have various gifts. We have things to learn. And I would just go back to say that if you are an individual who is licensed in one area, the best way to maintain the quality control is to have a board maybe look at your individual situation or another teacher's individual situation, prove your competencies by possibly some coursework, possibly portfolio work, or whatever needs to be done. There is a process right now through the variances that allow someone to be licensed, and we would want that quality control that is provided through the Board of Teaching and also sometimes then with the higher education institutions as well.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, this is just one tool. There are some who prefer the portfolio process. The Board of Teaching has an array of ways for those who want to become licensed in another subject area to do so. This would be another tool in their toolbox. Colleges of Education teacher prep programs have tools. This is just another tool for the teacher who believes that after he or she has studied for the praxis, and I know no one in here has taken the praxis because we're all licensed in our content areas if we're secondary, and we did not take the praxis because the Board of Teaching just enacted that in the early part of this century, in fact, at the end of the 20th and moved into the 21st. But this is another tool, and that's the way we need to look at it. It's another option. And I say hats off to someone who is willing to study for the praxis, who is going to read about the content outside of what the study might suggest, talk to colleagues, probably has been on a variance, very likely, teaching already in that subject area. I mean, that's what I've learned from the teachers who have emailed me. They're on variances. Some of them are on waivers. They feel they're very competent, and they feel they can pass this test. I want to give them that opportunity.
Are there any further testifiers to this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. morning. My name is Alan Hoffman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Teaching.
And I'm Deirdre Kramer. I'm a representative of the Minnesota Board of Teaching, and I'm Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Hamline University.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. The Board of Teaching looked at this at our last monthly meeting, and we have some concerns. We, have, as a state credentialing agency, of course, have been given responsibility for assuring the public that all teachers are competent to walk into a classroom and teach. This, when we issue a license, it's based on content understanding through significant coursework as well as a praxis test at the end to ensure understanding of content. It's based on the deep understanding of pedagogy designed for specific types of courses. That is, I, as a Spanish teacher, am going to approach my trade much differently than my colleague, Mr. Haugen, as a science teacher. It takes a different type of practice to do so, as well as age appropriateness. Again, I have, having worked with 15, 16, 17-year-olds all my career, would be, as I've told somebody this morning, frightened to walk into a classroom of first and second graders simply because of the age difference, and I need to know how to work with first and second graders. As well as significant clinical experiences. Students spend hundreds of hours out practicing their trade during prior to student teaching and student teaching. And we have some concerns that by adding a license area, by taking a test only, we would be missing a couple of these. There would be not the opportunity to provide practice in a clinical field experience with the age appropriateness necessary or in the understanding of the new content area and how to teach that content area. I always try to put a face on this, and as Mr. Haugen said, I'm going to testify with my face on this. I am a 712 Spanish teacher, have been for many, many years, and having been around the block and kind of paying attention to many things over the years, I suspect that I could pass the praxis test for elementary teaching license. I do not believe that I would be a good elementary teacher without having practiced that trade and having worked with a teacher in an elementary school setting and knowing a lot more about it than I do now. However, if this bill were to pass, I could pass that test and I could become an elementary teacher. The flip side of that is I'm sure that there are some elementary teachers out there who speak Spanish as their native language who could undoubtedly pass the Spanish praxis test and become a Spanish teacher, but I think that speaking the language does not guarantee that they know how to teach the language as well. So I ask for your consideration of caution as we move forward in this type of legislation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, from my perspective, I have just a few things to say. The intent of the bill is absolutely accurate. There is a need. Nobody's arguing about that. And higher ed and the Board of Teaching absolutely do have some tools to help teachers get additional licensure. So we're not arguing about that either. I'm not a psychometrician, but I'll be here to tell you that the praxis test was designed for a particular purpose. And the best way that I can demonstrate this is through a metaphor. It's like all of us are about ready to work in our gardens again. We all know what bulb planters look like. Well, the praxis test was designed like a bulb planter. Very specific purpose, get the bulb in the ground to grow. All of a sudden, we now have an effort to move this from being a bulb planter to a shovel. I'm sorry, the praxis test was not designed for this purpose. Now, you get to decide what you want to do with this. In my view, this is taking a bulb planter and figuring out I'm going to use it now like a shovel and I'm going to work through my garden. This is not going to do it. Psychometricians will tell you, and I think it'd be lovely for you to talk to ETS, the folks who designed the test, and ask them, who did they talk to? What standards were they looking at when they designed the test? What was their intent for this test? This isn't it. This is not what this test was designed to do. Now, Minnesota has a reputation to lose, and I feel like we are on the brink of losing that reputation. You have the Board of Teaching. The Board of Teaching is doing good work for you. If you're really concerned about this, send us the message. Give us the work. Tell us to figure out how to work with this problem. But please don't pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have a question for you, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this question for Mr. Hoffman.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Mr. Hoffman, in the Board of Teaching, is it your responsibility to grant the waivers also?
Yes, it is.
Can you, Mr. Chair?
Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me the process you go through to approve, when you approve a waiver and when you do not approve a waiver? If my school district sends in a waiver for a physical science teacher to teach earth sciences, for example, how do you determine whether to approve that waiver or not?
Mr. Hoffman.
That would actually be a variance.
Okay.
A waiver, yeah. And we the staff members look at that and determine the, really, variances are granted in a rather free fashion. But we remember that when you grant a variance, you as the administrator requesting this are signing on the dotted line that that person is in an approved program of study and will complete a full licensure program at the end of 3 years.
Thanks.
I see we have another testifier. Please state your name for the record.
Daniel Bittman, Director of Licensing and Teacher Quality at the department. I work very closely with Mr. Hoffman and the Board of Teaching in regard to licensing as well. Just a couple points to bring home. This year there were over 7,000 permissions granted to teachers in the field to teach areas that they had limited or no content knowledge. Those teachers were not required to demonstrate any type of knowledge in the field that they were teaching. Those are simply based on need. There were 805 waivers granted this year to individuals who, again, have demonstrated no knowledge, who had less than 3 years of teaching experience. What that means is that they are based 1 year at a time. The district needs to reapply for that each year. But there is no limit on the number of years an individual can have a waiver. In other words, an individual can have a waiver for 25 years and never have to demonstrate any content knowledge. In addition, there are between 17 and 21 states currently in the United States that offer testing, adding a license through the Praxis or through a national test. So this does comply with No Child Left Behind. And the idea is that an individual has been through an approved program, has a bachelor's degree, has the pedagogical skills in a field to meet the needs of the kids, and then demonstrates that competency. The bottom line is we have individuals in our schools who are teaching without any demonstration of knowledge. So this, again, as Representative Erickson said, this is one tool. This allows the local school district to reinforce that the teacher they currently have teaching science in their classroom without any knowledge has at least demonstrated some knowledge. So again, this is just one opportunity for them to demonstrate that knowledge.
Thank you. Is there any further testimony on this bill? Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, my belief has always been that the teacher who's in front of the students is the most important person in that classroom. I still believe that. However, you know, last year we asked the Board of Teaching to look into how we might come up with some alternative licensure. And they just didn't come up with anything. Now, we have been talking about this issue in this policy committee for about 6 years now. Mm-hmm. I remember people bringing bills because they had problems in their areas for quite a long time. We have done nothing. The longer we do nothing, the more we will have teachers getting waivers forever with no evidence that they even know that subject area, because school districts are somewhat desperate right now to get this done. So is it good for students that the only way they can get physics is online? There's no teacher in front of that class. Maybe there's a teacher at the other end who occasionally has some conversation online with a student, but that isn't the way I want my children taught, and I don't think it's the way most of us would want our children taught. So how long, folks, is it going to be before we do something? Before we do something that makes sense. Now, what I need to know is, why is the Praxis deemed sufficient for licensure when teachers first become licensed, and then why isn't it deemed sufficient later if they can pass the Praxis test? To me, I was an elementary teacher. Pedagogy could be applied to almost all the different subjects that I had to teach, and I did have to apply it in all those different subject areas. So how many additional credits does somebody need to teach physics instead of chemistry? Seriously. You know, how long are we going to hold these poor ALCs and charter schools and rural schools in a situation where they're sending somebody in for a waiver process and signing for it, and we know very little about that person's preparation? Why wouldn't this be a better alternative? And I didn't know 17 to 21 states are now doing it. I just know that we have a lot of waivers and a lot of ways to get around this when you are in a rural school district. Why don't we do something that makes sense? Do you want to respond to that, anybody? I'm sure somebody wants to.
Well, Mr. Chair, and
Representative Erickson,
I appreciate your comments about pedagogy, because that's what staff development is for. Staff development is available to us to enhance our teaching strategies, our management skills, and that's where I think the emphasis has to be in staff development. Staff development is not available to bone up on content for any area. It just is not the way staff development is used. So schools that are using staff development wisely are improving the teaching skills of their teachers by offering courses in various pedagogical approaches. And, you know, this is content. We are leaving the local districts in control of improving the strategies, the skills to deliver. But this is for the content. And if No Child Left Behind uses it as one of its criteria, and they have a very stringent requirement for highly qualified, I think we should honor that.
Representative Sikora.
Mr. Chairman, I guess, you know, I just think we're at a point here where it's time we did something other than sit and listen. So how long will we wait? If not now, when are we going to do something about this problem? It's not getting better, folks. It's getting worse. You know, we have very shrinking school districts. I hear about it all the time. How many bills do we have this year to grant people ability to transfer funds from one to the other, to get grants for school districts who can't afford to even maintain their buildings anymore? I mean, we have all sorts of problems in rural schools, and it's time we address this. And I hope that just once we will be positive and push this forward. It certainly beats all kinds of variances and waivers that we are doing now. Out of 50,000 teachers, we've got 7,500 out there with waivers. We don't know what they know.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, I heard the discussion about pedagogy and pedagogical courses. Well, a number of us sitting here are teachers. I'm stretching my brain. I know it's been a while, but I'm stretching my brain to think of what pedagogical course I took at college that was math specific. Mm-hmm. I think I can only remember the pedagogical courses being multidisciplinary, and I know I'm sitting in those courses with English teachers, with social studies teachers, and so maybe I'm wrong, but I can't think of any pedagogical courses that were actually discipline-specific. Now, it comes as no surprise that, you know, the two groups that are opposing this legislation, the Board of Teaching, because, you know, this is a little bit of loss of control. Alright, it's human nature to want to hang on to control, so it's not surprising that they're here to argue, and it's not surprising that Ms. Dietrich is here, Ms. Kramer is here arguing, you know, for the colleges, because it's actually loss of money. Alright, they've got, you know, this is a cash cow for them. Alright, so I don't blame her sit here asking us, you know, not to pass this, but I do take issue with her saying, send us a strong message and we'll fix this. We've been sending a strong message for 6 years now, and we haven't fixed it. They haven't fixed it, folks, and as Representative Sikora pointed out, things aren't improving in our small and rural school districts. They're getting worse. We're not having less variances and waivers. We're having more variance and waivers because they won't fix this. Now, we're here representing the people. We're not here representing institutions. I think it's time we step to the plate as a legislature and not send a message, but actually do something. Do something for these schools. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
Well, I think it would be sad if the legislature became the Board of Teaching. I don't think they want to get in that position, quite frankly. But I'm wondering if there's anyone here from higher ed who could talk about what kinds of alternative programs have been put in place and could explain maybe, and maybe Chairman can talk about the house rules or the house licensure and why that's not being used, et cetera. What is the house? I mean, it was referred to in your testimony, and perhaps we can have an explanation of what that is and why that's not being used. And then if there is someone from higher ed, I'd like to know what they're doing about alternative pathways.
Mr. Bittman, would you like to answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, the House is simply an opportunity for veteran teachers to demonstrate that they're highly qualified. So the House in itself is not a licensure, and it will not allow them to be in the classroom at all. It's a step further. Primarily, it's used for special education teachers and ESL teachers who don't have a degree in a core academic area such as English, math, reading, etc. So with their special ed license or ELL license, it will allow them to teach to that special ed discipline for which they have a license. I would like to comment, however, that we did receive a letter just 3 days ago from the Secretary of Education in which all states will be required to submit information on how they will limit the use of house after this year, because the federal deadline is June of 06. So what that means is we currently allow individuals on variances and waivers to use the house to demonstrate content knowledge, but now as of last week, we will be responsible for submitting information on how we will limit it to only certain groups. And alternative educators were not listed in the letter from the Secretary of Education. In fact, the only individuals that were mentioned were special education folks who are teaching multiple subjects and individuals in rural districts. And so that could potentially create a real burden for alternative learning centers and charter schools, etc., for which we have not set up that plan at the Department of Education yet because we just received that letter.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, would you also like to address, or I see we have somebody from higher ed, who could address the alternative pathways we already have in place and why they aren't working. Or maybe they are.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Cindy Crist. I'm System Director for P16 Collaboration for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Just a couple of comments. The first thing I'd like to say before I directly answer Representative Peterson's question is that I think all of us working in and around education understand the challenges the districts are facing. We know that there are small schools that have staffing challenges, changing patterns of course taking. Actually, I would say as an aside from the report that I hear is coming out today, an analysis of No Child Left Behind, maybe we can stop licensing teachers in anything besides reading and math, because one of the things that they found is that a lot of districts are only teaching reading and math right now because of NCLB testing. And also because they're innovative approaches. All of these things challenge us to think about what we're doing to prepare teachers and licensed teachers. But I would suggest that making it easier for people to become licensed is not a way to solve any of those problems. That said, we're working hard in higher ed. We really are working hard in higher ed to provide some new options, some alternative pathways to licensure. And I'll mention just a couple of them very briefly, and I could provide more information later to anybody that wants it. But a couple notably, Boise State University has developed a program that they call Fast Track to Licensure. It provides an opportunity for all the standards of effective practice. That's the how you teach, the pedagogy, child development. They offer all of those courses online. They work with candidates to help them prepare to submit a portfolio to the Department of Education for a review. They modify field experiences based upon their background. And they've put all of this together so that individuals can complete the process and be licensed in a year and sometimes less than a year. Metro State has developed a post-baccalaureate process for grades 5 through 12 licensure. This is another one that's mostly for career changers. The same thing is true at MSU Mankato. They actually put significant resources into a new program they've developed called MNCAP that's very similar to some of the alternative pathways proposals that have come before you this year and in recent years. They developed that program with K-12 teachers and administrators. They marketed it directly to every superintendent in the state and every member of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and they didn't get a single applicant. And I don't think anybody can point to the quality of that program or what they've done to promote it as a reason for the fact that nobody has taken them up on it. It's hard to see that there is an interest or a demand for these kinds of programs. There are other options that have been provided in math and science, but I think rather than talking any more about them now, I will just close by giving you one example, since we all like to talk about anecdotes and individual teachers that we know that we think can do one thing and another. I had an opportunity about a year ago to visit the STEP program in Anoka. You may know about this. It was the first middle college program in Minnesota. It really is kind of a 10 through 14 grade program that's fully aligned with Anoka Technical College in the Anoka Hennepin School District. And one of the opportunities I had while I was there was to chat with a couple of gentlemen who teach courses in their law enforcement program. And I was very curious about how they had become teachers, what their qualifications were, because they were obviously career changers. They'd both been law enforcement officers. They had gone through a program. I don't remember now the institution. It wasn't one of ours. I was disappointed by that. But they'd gone through a program to become licensed. And they said, you know, we have another colleague who's teaching with us. I think perhaps it was a non-licensed community expert. And they said, you know, I just don't think he's going to make it. And he said, well, you know, what are you talking about? Well, he doesn't understand about adolescent development. He doesn't understand about adolescent behavior. He doesn't know how to work with these students. He doesn't understand how to reach them. And those were all things they said that they had learned in their licensing program. So they could very clearly see, you know, he knew the content. He had worked in law enforcement as they had. But it was quite clear to them that he had no understanding of how to work with adolescents. And I bring that up because I think one of our greatest concerns about this bill is that to teach effectively, obviously you need to know the subject area, you need to have a passion for it, but you also need to know how to connect with the students in your class. And being a skilled and licensed elementary teacher does not mean that even if you know physics or Spanish or American history well, you're necessarily going to have the skills and knowledge to know how to teach that to high school students. And unless I don't understand something about this bill, and that certainly is possible, as I read it, regardless of what you're licensed in, you could add license in any other grade level, content area, any other area of licensure simply by taking a content-specific test.
Thank you. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot has been said and covered since I got my name on the list. I think in general, I would certainly hope we are all focusing on providing what is the very best for our kids, and I would hope that fixing wouldn't just mean taking care of an immediate problem without making sure we're doing the right thing as we do it. I thought, and maybe that it's a quick question with a nod of the head, I thought at least in the department bill there was a compromise brought forth that was new, it was in terms of science, that along with tenure or 3 years of teaching, that would be enough to trigger a praxis test in an area that is related. And I see the nods of the heads that, you know, that was at least in my mind a new step, even that, you know, with causing some concern. But there was some connection with that that would make that somewhat sensible in terms of either the experience, the waiver, or the content area relationship. And that's what I heard from a number of the testifiers or the testimony, that teachers who were saying they needed this were teachers who had waivers, who had variances. So they were in that area for one reason already, or there was a relationship between what one studies in an ag, getting an ag degree and science. But my question, really, the last witness kind of got to it. If I understand the bill, Representative Erickson, someone with a bachelor's degree in English, which I have, could take the praxis in math. And if I pass the math praxis test, I would be licensed then as a math teacher. And I guess the question I have is, what is the reliability of the praxis test to indicate my competence as an English teacher? What's the confidence interval? What's the margin of error? How reliable is that as an instrument to do what we would be asking it to do in a much broader fashion than anything that has been brought forth so far?
Representative Erickson.
I think that Mr. Bittman will answer that, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Mr. Bittman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorn, right now we are using it for all of our teachers. And so it's good enough right now for our current programs, but one thing that I would comment on is this is for a teacher who has already demonstrated that they have gone through an approved program and have met pedagogical skills in a field. So this is a licensed teacher. This isn't someone who's coming off the street with no teacher preparation wanting to be a teacher. So that's one thing. The department would suggest that the Praxis 2 test in this bill, as it is written, is not the only requirement or the only test of that individual. That's a person who's demonstrated that pedagogical and content knowledge through the praxis and through an approved program, so the college has recommended them. Their superintendent or principal has demonstrated that they have met or will meet the needs of those students, and so they're putting their reputations on the line as well, saying that they're accountable for that teacher. And then the bottom line is, there, like I had said earlier, there's 7,100 permissions granted this year where individuals are in the classroom with no demonstration of knowledge. And so allowing a teacher to be in the classroom and placing them in there, again, have to be really looked at. But we believe, the department believes, that the praxis test is one avenue that would allow an administrator and a district to put that individual in the classroom.
So, Mr.
Representative Dorn,
what you're telling me that, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but that if I have a degree in English and I've got the teacher preparation in English, if I took the math test, that somehow or other, or if I took the, is the praxis that general then that I could score a passing score, or is it, if it's math specific, if I pass it, would I have a math license in both secondary and elementary?
Mr. Bittman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorn, my understanding is, since you are a licensed teacher and have a professional license in something, that if you pass that specific math test, that you would be able to gain licensure in that math area. I would also like to recommend or put some information out there that those tests are somewhat rigorous, and we have statistics in the Title II report that indicate the number of individuals who aren't passing those specific areas. So it is specific to math.
Mr. Chair, then,
Representative Dorn,
then if I might, again, do we know what the confidence interval is and what the margin of error is of the praxis exam for doing this kind of work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorn, that information is available through ETS and the Board of Teaching. The Board of Teaching sets those scores and has that information as they set the scores for each particular test. So, yes, that information is available.
And Mr. Chair, one more. Right now, as I understand it, we have people who can have waivers for a long time, and I appreciate the point that someone could have an entire career and not demonstrate. Would the failure to pass the praxis test result in someone being denied a waiver after the failure? Is there anything in that area? And then secondly, would we be requiring people on waivers after a certain point to take the praxis test to see if they really did have the knowledge that they were being waived to teach?
Mr. Bittman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorn, my understanding from the recent letter from the Secretary of Education is that states will be required to limit the use of house. And so an individual teaching on a waiver will not meet any federal guidelines at all if they're not able to use the house unless they have that academic major or have passed the Praxis 2 test as it's written.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clinzy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. we have heard today that from the opposition that we are holding standards high. We have 7,500 variances. Who are you trying to fool? Those folks have not met the assurance of pedagogy. We have no assurance they're understanding adolescents. We have no assurance that they have a specific pedagogical content in their area. Over 7,500 people, and you're telling me that those folks are meeting high standards? That's a lie to the public, if that's what you're going to go out there and say. Yeah, you've set high standards, but then we've also got this catch-all variance program, which I'm glad is there for the schools who need it. But then we have an alternative here, which sets the bar a little higher than the variances. And we're saying that's too low. Well, what's too low is what's in reality. So I'm sick and tired of hearing about the lie that those standards are so high. Yeah, they're high, but the people with 7,500 variances, we don't have people meeting those. And we have an option here to have those people on the variances raised to a higher level. That's the truth. I worked in a department where over half the people were on a lifetime teaching license. It was not subject area specific. They had gone to school for 2 years. I had gone to school for 5 years to get my license, and I did actually have to take a specific methodology course for social studies. And yet they could teach everything under the sun and had been there for 30 years doing it. Are we going to say all those teachers were crappy teachers? I don't think Education Minnesota would get up here and say that. And this sets the bar at least five times higher than that. So if you think you're protecting kids by just saying whatever you hope would happen in an ivory tower, I would have to say it's not doing it. And if you're saying that it does do it, then you're saying that those teachers that are teaching at the two-year lifetime teacher license, which maybe a couple of you at this table had, that they were not good teachers.
Members, we are at the end of our time for right now, so we are going to recess.
Chair, I'd like to renew my motion. No?
Representative Erickson renews her motion to...
Well, Mr. Chair, let me make a comment first.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. A year ago, the Board of Teaching delivered a report to us that has all the passing praxis exams listed, what the passing score was, what number of students who failed it. This is teacher candidates. And you should have that in your file because I have it. And it was a result, I believe, of a report that was...
Members, if we could we still have about 30 seconds left here, if we could listen to the testifier. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair and Committee, I just wanted to remind members that we do have access to a report from the Board of Teaching from 2005. And, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you want to lay this bill over, but, you know, I think we should vote on it. So.
We're going to need to... There's several people who have questions on this bill, so we're going to...
We'll lay it over till tonight? Is that when we're meeting?
Yes, we'll recess the committee until 4 p.m.
Yeah.
Or within a... reasonable amount of time. That listen for an announcement on the floor. Right now we are scheduled at 4 p.m. in room 10. So until then, we stand in recess. Reconvene the Education Policy Reform Committee. I believe that the author has an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A3 amendment.
Does everybody have a copy of the amendment? The A3 amendment. Representative Erickson, do you want to speak about the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, as we were debating this morning, and as I visited with some of the testifiers, I listened to your concerns. I don't know if this goes far enough for some of you, but page 3, line 4, after license, of course, this is where the only language is for this bill, we would insert is recommended by the superintendent of the district in which the teacher is employed to pursue licensure in an additional subject area. And then on line 5, after the period, insert, a license to teach in an additional subject area is valid only for the grade levels for which the teacher was licensed to teach before taking a Praxis 2 exam under this paragraph, unless the superintendent recommends to the board that the additional subject area license allow the teacher to teach other grade levels.
Is everybody clear on the amendment? Any discussion to the amendment? Representative Carlson. The chair can't help you with your chair. Representative Carlson.
One of the issues that we talked about this morning was someone might ultimately, let's say you were, your background, experience had been on the secondary level, that you might all of a sudden be teaching in the elementary grades. Now, my teaching certificate still reads secondary, social studies, which then was grade 7. Well, now those would be that's what I was licensed in at one time or other. I had probably experienced in most of those grade levels. But as I read this, then if the superintendent approved, I could go down into the elementary grades. And is that the end of it? I guess my question of the author or the superintendent that's now forward.
Representative Erickson, I'm not sure if you heard the question. Should I have Representative Carlson repeat it?
Well, probably for the sake of Superintendent Haugen, who is probably going to answer the question,
Okay. Because
he and I talked about this after the committee hearing this morning.
Representative Carlson, could you repeat your question? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a retired teacher, so I still have a license, and mine happens to be in social studies and some other areas. It's secondary, meaning grades 7 through 12. The question I have, the way this reads, then, would a teacher licensed as I am be able to then petition you and with your approval teach in an elementary school?
Superintendent Haugen, could you state your name for the record and then go ahead and answer the question?
Thank you. Jay Haugen, Superintendent, CPI.
Thank you.
Proceed. Mr. Chair, Representative, is it Carlson?
Yes.
Thank you. As it reads here, under certain circumstances that a superintendent would determine that could happen.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess the question I have is that the intent that a secondary licensure situation would be, is that the intent that you could use a secondary teacher in an elementary setting?
Superintendent Hogan.
That would be the intent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. To the bill. Questions to the bill? The next person I have on the list is Representative Eakin. Members, we are going to take 15 minutes for questions or comments, so please keep your comments or questions concise and to the point. Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who this question should be directed towards, but it seems to me there's two concerns here that seem to be in conflict, one dealing with the quality of the teacher in the classroom, the other one dealing with what we can offer our students, and especially in the smaller rural schools, for instance, where we sometimes can't offer specialist teachers to cover all the different areas. So I was wondering, it seems to me that when I hear all the different variances and waivers that are being issued, that we probably are seeing all classes being offered that we'd like to see out in the rural areas and some of these smaller schools, because there are, what's the number again, it's over 7,000 variances that are being issued. So I was just wondering if there is a problem in the rural areas as far as being able to offer all the classes that we would like to see in our classes, or is that being met through the variances and the waivers that are being issued?
Superintendent Hogan or Representative Erickson?
Superintendent
Hogan.
Mr. Chair, you know, it's probably fair to say that in the end, in the 11th hour, we do manage to, by working with the Board of Teaching and the department, manage to offer most anything that we really, really need to offer. The problem is there is not a plan for offering that. We have to go through everything else and get to the 11th hour and then just put somebody in there, as was kind of mentioned, whether or not we know they're totally prepared or not. You know, this is would be an opportunity to I think, plan that whole thing out better.
Okay. And Chair?
Representative Beacon.
And thank you, Superintendent Hogan. I agree. I think that we do need to plan these things out more, and I understand that probably one of the biggest difficulties is always having to get the waiver year after year after year. If I'm correct, that has to be done on an annual basis. So really what this bill would do would be to allow you to be able to do this and do the practice exam, which will at least show some level of accountability or level of ability here. So I guess I just would like to express, support in favor of this. I feel that it would help out some of the rural areas, although I do have concerns as well to make sure that we offer the compensation levels necessary to attract people into the profession so that we don't end up with teaching shortages and use this as a way to get around some of the shortage problems we may face in the future. But certainly we need to, I think, do more to create some flexibility in our rural communities. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich, you're on the list. So you want to pass? Or Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to, in the interest of time, pass.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question possibly for the author, maybe for some of the other folks who came and testified earlier today. My understanding is that the praxis test is a content test, and that the strength of the bill is that it assures that people have a content knowledge. Representative Erickson, what is the content needed to teach special ed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, there is a specific test for special education. And if you give me a second here, I will get to it. But there is a praxis to test to teach special education. Education of exceptional students, core content knowledge. The CAT score in Minnesota is 140. It is one of the lowest. Missouri has 160. Our range for females is between 127 and 200. For males, between 130 and 200. And then I have the breakdown among ethnic groups. But there is a specific praxis to test for special education. I have not reviewed it because I've only been interested in looking at my own to see how well I'll do on the practice test.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Representative Erickson. The fact that there's a test still doesn't get to the question of what's the content of that. What's the content of knowledge needed to teach ELL?
Representative Dabney, I think we need to hear from Mr. Bittman because I misunderstood what you were asking. And Thank he you. Is going to note.
Mr. Bittman.
Mr. Sharon, representatives, I believe that in the bill, special ed was excluded and not allowed to add a content because there isn't a specific core academic area for special ed. However, Representative Erickson is correct in that there is a special ed general test for the praxis too for licensure.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
I'm trying to see where, I guess maybe I'm having some difficulty reading lines 3.3 to 3.11 in the original bill, as to whether that is defining the licenses that people have to have in order to go through this process, or the licenses that they may access by going through this process. But I'm not seeing at least a clear and explicit exception for special ed or an exception for ELL. You know, these areas that are of shortage and need, but that don't have a content knowledge similar to social studies or English or math or that science thing.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gaffney, would you like to offer an amendment to make sure we exclude special education?
I'll consider that.
Representative Gaffney.
Thank you.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question from this morning was actually for Mr. Bittman. Yes. And again, if we can all recall this morning's conversation, as I was listening to all the discussions, I'm just wondering if, in your opinion, are we trying to fix a problem of teacher shortage in rural and charter schools that's caused in part by funding cuts set forth actually at the direction of the legislature, by reducing the licensure requirements? Are we fixing the wrong problem is basically my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very difficult question. All I could say is that could be considered one interpretation. The department would say that the praxis test is simply another measure, and that even things such as coursework or time in the classroom, et cetera, none of those things in isolation would assure us that they would be successful. And so as for the teacher shortage part, very difficult to answer.
Representative Peterson.
My question was on special ed also, so I think it was probably answered. I am concerned because I think there's a lot of content that isn't covered in that particular praxis exam for all the areas. There are numerous areas of special ed. I can't believe they're all covered in that one praxis area. And but there was discussion on this already.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm still struggling with just what the problem is and then how the bill solves the problems that I've been hearing about. And I guess maybe the superintendent could elaborate. Maybe, again, I wasn't tracking. But it seems to me that if at the 11th hour, somehow or other, we are filling the needs in the classrooms, I'm not sure how this bill helps us, you know, fill the needs in the classroom any faster than the 11th hour, because I don't understand how allowing someone to take the praxis test to get a license would coincide with the ability to make sure we have teachers in the classroom that we hope will be able to help kids succeed. Maybe I misunderstood the answer. I just don't see how the bill connects to that problem.
Superintendent.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Whenever we do something as a school, set a budget, set a schedule for the next year, you know, there's a lot of creativity and planning that go into it. And the more pieces we know and are assured of ahead of time, you know, the better decisions we can make, the more things, pieces that get put into place, and I know the better school we run. And so this, to me, would be one of those things. It's not the only hurdle we have to getting a right teacher in the classroom. But if this hurdle is taken away, if it's one where I know now that this teacher has a license, I'm not going to have to go through the, you know, advertising, all the steps of trying to recruit someone for one or maybe teaching one class or two classes. I know I have someone that year after year is consistently going to be in that classroom, has the license. it's just a much better thing. You know, it's tough being a teacher, as a person who has done it, it's tough being a teacher on waiver or a teacher on variance, especially when it's something that every year you don't know if you're going to do that or again the next year. It just really adds some consistency. And I really want to go back to the point that I know I haven't had a chance to say this. This isn't the only decision we make. It's not like, oh, they have a license, now I'm going to put them in the classroom. I have fifth and sixth grade teachers that are elementary certified that I don't put in first and second grade. They're just not cut out for it. That's just, they're wonderful with young adolescents. I just know that as a school administrator, that that's not their skill. The best math teacher we ever had at CPI was an elementary teacher who, in the 11th hour, we had to have someone, we couldn't find someone to teach these classes in math to come to CPI. We got a variance. He ended up teaching variance for 3 years in math in our high school and has never gone back to the elementary. He found something he was terrific at. And there just are all kinds of choices we make as a school. This isn't something where we're just going to slam dunk, say the person has a certificate, we're going to put them in there. There's a lot of thought, a lot of staff development and training. Those are things the school districts take care of routinely. We're not going to make bad choices with this.
Representative Peterson.
Yeah. I have just one more question. Point. With the language that we just passed, it's up to the superintendent then whether this teacher can go to a new, can even take the praxis. I mean, they could take the praxis, but they won't be qualified then to teach in that classroom unless the superintendent makes that decision. It sounds to me like it's the superintendent now who determines if a teacher can do this particular praxis. Before, any teacher could take the praxis and determine that they would be qualified to get a license to teach in another area. It wasn't dependent on the superintendent. Am I reading that right?
Representative Peterson.
Chair, Mr. Chair, and I'll direct that at, Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Peterson, I don't even have them in front of me anymore. I've taken them all away.
Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, if I can take a stab at that right now, the praxis, you take the practice for hoots and giggles. It doesn't do anything for you right now. The bill, as Representative Erickson first brought forward, would say if you took the praxis and successfully passed the praxis too, then you'd get the license. After this morning's testimony, there seemed to be a lot of people who were comforted with the waiver and variance process, which relied solely upon a superintendent writing a letter to the Board of Teaching saying, give this person a waiver, give this person a variance, and the Board of Teaching does it 7,000 times on variances, over 800 times on waivers. Representative Erickson's actually putting a little more teeth into the waiver and variance process by saying, you know, and pass the praxis also. So I think it's a much better bill with the addition of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer my amendment. This is an oral amendment, line 9. Before the period.
What page?
Page 3, excuse me, line 9. Before the period, the only period in that line, insert and excludes special education, English language learning, and any other license not specifically listed in this paragraph. Period.
Does everybody understand the amendment? Any comments concerning the amendment? To the amendment. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't really have too much of a problem with the amendment, but I'm going to go back to the superintendent again. You know, these teachers don't get a license and then show up and take over a class. And whether they have a license, they're going to repeat some of the things people have said, but before someone comes to teach, you know, if they're fully licensed and ready to go, and they don't get hired unless the superintendent is involved in the interview process and decides it's a good person. They don't get hired unless the principal and the superintendent and maybe even a school board group and maybe even some teachers get together and decide what section they're going to be in, what class they're teaching. I think the idea that we have to think that here in St. Paul, we have to make sure that we put in that, well, we're not, just because they passed the test, we're not going to allow them to teach here because that superintendent and that principal and that school board might put them in a bad place in front of their kids. I find it very ridiculous, to be honest about it. You know, we got superintendents that are hired, they're professionals, they know their schools, they know their kids. They're not going to put teachers in front of kids that shouldn't be there. And I suppose I'll support this because it makes sense, but I'm not sure we have to put all these qualifications in. I think we have... And that was going to be my comment later for the superintendent, too. I just think I have to be careful about thinking about micromanage this.
Any other comments to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, just let me make this comment. In an earlier version of this bill, in an early draft, I did have an exception, and it was not included in this particular draft. So I had been originally thinking about that, and then for some reason I eliminated it in the draft that I sent forth for the bill introduction.
Last comment from Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been waiting since this morning, so I appreciate your time. And basically, this was going to be a question for Superintendent Haugen, and I think we've touched all around that, but I guess unless you said everything you wanted to say, I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to the fact that getting a teacher, or have a teacher having a license, and then you get them teaching in the classroom, there's a huge process in the middle that is really something that we have to make sure we remember, and that's the principals and the superintendent, the school board administration, putting teachers in a good position, with or without, with whether it's a variance or whether it's with a practice license. Could you just, this is your open forum for a minute or two, Superintendent Haugen, to put that plug in to make sure we remember that before we go ahead and vote on this.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's our number one job.
Okay.
You know, it's our number one job. In the end, it all comes down to having a great teacher in front of our kids. A teacher who's prepared, not just knowledge-wise, but temperament-wise for that age, with skill-wise, with good pedagogy, who's had good staff development. You know, those are the choices we make all the time. When we put together the schedule, it's not just putting, you know, names in slots. It's thinking about that person and their skills and what they're good at and how well they'll get along with that class of students. We stay awake at night thinking about those things. We have meetings talking over those things, making sure we're thinking correctly about those things. In the end, how good a school year we have depends more on those decisions we make than any others that we've made throughout the year. So those are our most important decisions. Those are the things that we take the most care of. And in the end, you know, the more flexibility we have, the better ability we have to make these decisions. It is more likely that we make a decision that we don't think is best because of our hands are tied by one thing or another and don't have the right teacher in front of the right kids because of some other things extraneous to the school. We want our best team in front of the kids, and anything we can do, you know, such as this bill, to give us the opportunity to put the best teacher in front of those kids is what we want.
Thank you. Before we proceed, Ms. Larson has informed me that we have to do a letter addition. Because one of our prior amendments on page 3, line 4, the word license needs now to be license says.
Oh, yes.
So I'll offer that oral amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Erickson renews her motion that House File 3326, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The bill is approved.
Representative Biskins, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 3908 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance.
Thank you. Okay, to your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 3908 directs the Board of Teaching to develop an interdisciplinary teaching license. This isn't looking for any waiver processes. This bill isn't looking to skirt around any issues. This bill is looking at the requesting the board to undertake this proposition. Madam Chair and members, you know, we've been dealing with this issue, asking politely of the Board of Teaching for the last 6 years or so to please come up with an interdisciplinary license. And then every year we adjourn the committee with feeling pretty comfortable that they got the message and they're going to do so. And every year we come back to the legislature with the same issue before us. Madam Chair and members, there are some incredible things being attempted in school districts throughout the state. Some breakthrough approaches to teaching and learning about looking at the acquisition of knowledge, not in an egg carton fashion where you've got your little cells, one with math, one with science, one with social studies, one with English, but where you blend together in a multidisciplinary, multi-interdisciplinary approach, a more holistic approach to teaching and the learning of the child in the high school program. Unfortunately, Madam Chair and members, that type of program puts us at odds with rules and recommendations currently on the books. Rules and recommendations as far as licensure teachers, which serves a purpose and is good, I'm not saying throw anything out, all right, but which doesn't get us with the type of licensure we need to look at new approaches. Now, we have some awesome schools doing good things. One that I can think of, and a number of members went with me as we toured Avalon last year as members of this committee, where they have project-based learning. And the kids, you talk to the kids, they're excited about what they're doing. You talk to the teachers, they're excited about what they're doing, but they're frustrated because they're not technically teaching in the area of the licensure. We're asking the Board of Teaching to develop. We're not asking anymore. We're tired of asking. We're directing the Board of Teaching to finally get off your butts, develop an interdisciplinary license. We as the legislature are listening not to the bureaucrats, but we're listening to the people. And we as the Education Committee are sending out a directive that we need to get this done now. Madam Chair, thank you for allowing me this brief moment. At this time, I have some folks with me who'd like to speak to the bill.
Would you please state your name for the record?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Biskins. For the record, my name is Bob Wadle. Today I'm testifying for Education Evolving and the Minnesota Quality Learning Coalition, which includes a number of different organizations, such as the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, the Minnesota Online Learning Association, the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, and others. These organizations are in support of this bill. Madam Chair, although
although I was a member of the Board of Teaching Task Force, which addressed the interdisciplinary license, I want to make it very clear that I am not here today, testifying as a member of that committee. Just a quick summary, Madam Chair. I just want to make the three points. One is the bill before you puts into statute really what you asked the Board of Teaching to do a year ago, and so it provides a strong basis for which the board can then go back and complete the license. Second, the bill really recognizes that kids, as we all know, kids do need different kinds of learning programs. Our country is trying to do something that no society in the history of the planet has ever done, and that is educate all children at high levels. No one has ever done this successfully. So it would be kind of naive, I believe, to think that we're going to be able to educate all of our children using basically the same model. That we really do need different kinds of teaching and learning models by people highly trained in the type of teaching and learning model in which they are working, if we in fact are going to meet this bold goal of educating all of our kids. The third point that I want to make is that Minnesota is going to have to once again step forward and be a national leader here, just as Minnesota has with your leadership over the last 20, 25 years on any number of areas. As Representative Biskins indicated that there are some issues with No Child Left Behind and this particular proposal. But we're going to have to step forward and get some of those issues resolved at the national level, because clearly, many other states around this country are going to be faced and are being faced with the very same problem that you've been grappling with in previous bills. So this may be another case where Minnesota steps forward and says, we will take the leadership in this area of licensure, because we are going to have different kinds of schools and different kinds of programs for the many students that we have that currently are not being successful. And so that's another reason why this bill is so important. One of these successful models, in addition to the current model of basically courses and in our middle schools and high schools, where those courses are taught, as Representative Biskin said, in individual classrooms, that works very well for a lot of kids. No one is suggesting that it doesn't. But for any number of kids, that method is not very successful at all. And we do need this interdisciplinary type of model that Dee Thomas, the principal of New Country School, who will testify in just a minute, will discuss with you. And if you didn't get a chance to go to Avalon and you'd like to sojourner in southern Minnesota, I'd ask you to buy a ticket to go see her school, because it's outstanding. So I guess what the bill does do is it lays out what these interdisciplinary competencies really need to be, so that teachers who are working in these different kinds of schools will be able to access the licensure that they really need to be successful teachers in those schools. It's one thing to be a licensed teacher to teach physics or to teach English or whatever. But it's another thing to teach in this kind of a model. You need to have different types of skills and competencies, and this bill provides a method for that to occur. Students today are a lot different than they were just 5 or 10 years ago. Certainly technology has driven this to a great extent. They're more individualized than ever before, and they learn a great deal outside of school than they ever did before. So they really are probably the first generation of individualized generation of learners that learn at their own pace, and they learn things together. They don't learn things compartmentalized. And so what Ms. Thomas will testify will be the type of learning model that
that is really being contemplated by this particular bill. So basically this bill, a quick summary, is really consistent with the recommendations of many of the task force members of the Board of Teaching to develop this kind of interdisciplinary license. It really only applies to middle school and to high school. It only applies if a school board decides to have this kind of program. So no one is mandating that this kind of program be put into place. But it does say that if you do have this kind of interdisciplinary program, which is a significantly different kind of school, then you really need to make sure that you have the teachers with the competencies to be able to function and teach effectively into that kind of model. Now, just finally, Madam Chair, the Board of Teaching and the Department have testified that there are waivers and the house process that can be gone through. But once again, we're saying, well, in order to teach in these successful schools, somehow you need to have a waiver, or you need to go through some other loophole to be able to work in this kind of a school. We're suggesting that you codify what the licensure requirements are, or direct the Board of Teaching to codify what those licensure requirements are in these schools that are operated successfully with children right now, and get on with it. That we know what those skills are. Let's codify them so that these people don't continually have to come back and get some type of a waiver or a variance to continue working in these types of schools. So, Madam Chair, I would hope that you would support this new and exciting effort, and I'd like to turn it over to Dee Thomas.
Thank you for your testimony. Would you please state your name for the record?
I'm Dee Thomas, and I'm a teaching administrator for Minnesota New Country School in Henderson. I'm also a tenure waivered teacher, and I'm also a former member of the State Board of Teaching. So as I come to you, to talk a little bit about the type of programs that we're looking at. Minnesota New Country School, or a project-based school, or a school that might use this type of licensure, would be a school that would individualize education for every student. And we do that. Every student is on an individualized learning plan, which is much different than happens in many, many schools. We utilize the world as our classroom. We try to get kids out. We try to get kids involved. We have them on the Internet. Every student utilizes a computer on a daily basis to make sure that they're working that way. Teachers act as facilitators in these particular settings, with the emphasis on the students as the doers, not receivers. So the students really get actively involved in the education that they do. And teachers become coaches. They become facilitators. They become guides on the side. They help make sure that students reach all of the state standards. And students have to graduate with all of the state standards that are recommended. They have to do all of the state testing, and we want them to come through that. But we want them to do that through their areas of interest, and then by weaving all of these things into projects and making sure that it happens. So they do learning by doing, and that's really a key component of what they do. As I look at students that have come out of some of these programs, and we have a number of schools in the state of Minnesota that use these project-based programs, what we're finding is that they have some of the lowest remediation, or they're the lowest remediation sites in the state. Minnesota New Country was one of those, so as our students are doing post-secondary, they are not needing the remediation that we're seeing happening in other places. It's a very efficient programming. We are finding that we're able to get anywhere from 80% to 86% of our money going directly to students, which I think is something that many of the education committees are looking at right now. Last year, 100% of our graduates were post-secondary accepted. So we are preparing students for post-secondary, and we have a higher than state average ACT test scores. So even though we're not doing classes and bells, our students are able to compete. Our students are being red flagged by different colleges and universities. Princeton has red flagged a couple of our graduates, looking at a transcript that looks much different than a traditional transcript, saying, because we put in there that our students have time management, goal setting, task completion, critical thinking, problem solving, which are all the key things that teachers need to be trained on in order to do that at a much more intense rate. We have the students that come to these schools are not selected students. Right now we're operating at New Country with about 30% free and reduced lunch. In some of our other schools we have up to 95% free and reduced lunch. We're operating currently with 30% special ed. So we're finding that our special ed numbers are growing at a fast rate. Of our incoming students for the last couple of years, we are finding that 70% of our incoming students are 2 years or more behind in reading levels. But with individualized instruction, we're able to look at them. We're able to create a project around increasing their reading abilities. These programs are working very well for some students that I'm afraid we would lose if we didn't work with them closely. And what we're looking for is to find some way to codify what we're doing to make sure that these teachers are recognized for the work that they do and to make sure that there's a license out there so we can give that to those teachers and say, this is a legitimate program. This is recognized by the state. This is something that the state looks at and says, you know, these are specific skills that you need. These are specific skills that you have to have in order to do this type of teaching. And I think the teaching in these schools is intense teaching. To have 17 to 20 students all on individualized plans working up to 10 projects apiece takes a lot of work and a lot of management. It takes a lot of communication, a lot of research ability on the part of the teachers, a lot of confidence in allowing students to become responsible for their learning, and making sure that you're giving them all of the assistance that they need to do that. In teachers, they have to be passionate about becoming lifelong learners and helping their students become the same thing. You have to be technology savvy. And for me, some days that's a real challenge. I'm definitely a digital immigrant, and I'm teaching digital natives on a regular basis. They know much more than I do, but I'm having to get more technology savvy every day. Everything we do is real-world focused. We really want to make sure that we're preparing kids. Not only do they need to have the standards, but they also need to have time management, goal setting, task completion, problem solving. And those are all the things that work into these programs. We have to prepare students for change. As I'm reading statistics right now that are saying students will probably change jobs a minimum of 8 times or change careers 8 times in their lifetime. I have to make sure that I'm teaching kids to be ready for change. They're probably not going to hold a career for a whole life, similar to what I've done. And we have to make sure that we're preparing kids for that. So my concern is we've granted waivers so many times. I have 10. At some point in time, is it time to make it into a license? So, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. I understand, Representative Biffen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I believe you have some people who have called to testify in opposition of the bill, and you'll probably hear from them at this time.
Correct. Representative Farrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know. President Biskins, do you want questions now? Because I wanted to ask of these people, but I can wait if you want to have the testifiers first.
It served the pleasure of the chair. If you want to have the questions while they're here, that's probably.
I think that would make excellent sense. Representative Rowan?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Thomas, you had 10 waivers, and one of the things that came to my mind earlier, and I'm wondering why did you keep getting waivers without taking one of these alternative paths that the colleges and universities say they have so many of? I couldn't figure out why people kept getting waivers and wouldn't go that route.
Because there's no license for what I do. Madam Chair, Representative Riley, we're generalists first, specialists second. So I do have a home economics, consumer homemaking degree, but I do a little bit of English. I do a little bit of social studies. I do a little bit of science. I work, you know, around the world with these students, and I make sure that I pull in the experts that I need if I don't have the expertise myself. And we always work in teams of teachers in grading and scoring projects. But for me to go back and pick up a degree take a practice path or whatever, and every single discipline area, mm-hmm. to me would be, number one, overwhelming. Mm-hmm. Number two, I don't know that I have the time or money to do all of the studying and everything else that I would need to pass that test. And number three, if I can use community experts to meet those needs of students, I'll do that. So there's nothing that I can do right now to legitimize what's happening at New Country.
Okay. And then thank you, Ms. Thomas. Representative Garland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Wadle, would you, I like this bill much better than the one we just had because it keeps the same high standards, but yet it does offer flexibility for small schools and charter schools and alternative schools and rural schools. I know you don't know, but I know, plugging into your vast knowledge and wisdom, do you think if we had this bill, that would eliminate most of the need for the other bill, which, kind of accepts that we don't have quite as qualified of teachers in some schools?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, you're right. I don't know. But I think that bill was really focused on the model that most schools use, and that is you have a science class and a history class, et cetera. And that bill was addressing how do you get people who are qualified to teach in that kind of a model, a science teacher, a social studies teacher. This bill would not impact that. This bill really says that if you have a different kind of organization of how you deliver instruction, as opposed to, as Representative Biskin said, in all of the different categories, where you do it more in a holistic approach, in an interdisciplinary approach, that takes a whole different set of skills, and that's what this bill is really all about.
Thank you, Mr. Riddle. Are there any further questions of these testifiers? If not, I believe there's someone wishing to speak in opposition to this bill. Welcome to committee, and I understand that I, too, am happy to see you in this committee. We're kind of going for a hat trick here, I believe, today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think I'll turn it over to Garnet Franklin.
Did you state your name for the record? Sorry.
My name is Garnet Franklin. I'm staff at Education Minnesota, and I'm happy to have a moment to speak with you. I, too, served on the Board of Teachings Committee for the many hours that we put in trying to study and make some sense of the problems that we were trying to fix and how we could best provide for students in these unique learning environments. A personal observation about that experience, we ran round and round in circles because we didn't answer some foundational questions that I hear you asking, here today. The question that Dee and Bob bring to you is, these are people who have additional and exceptional skills over and above those teachers who hold a conventional license. Therefore, they should have a unique license. But then they also talk about students' programs that are organized in a different and unique way from those conventional schools that have math classes and science classes. They talked about individualized learning and project-based learning. So Representative Breiling's question is right on. Last year there was a great deal of confusion about could these same people with the same license help out in those small schools and charter schools and alternative schools, and the answer is maybe. It all hinges on how the program is organized. It's not a licensing issue. It's how we offer instruction within the school or within a part of the school. If it is project-based and individualized and the teacher is a facilitator of student learning, then that's the way instructional delivery is handled. It's not a lecture. It's not a little small group and discussion and read aloud and worksheets and the other things we think of in conventional instructional environments. What we didn't have was a clear definition of what the instructional delivery model would be for which this new license was to be generated. So almost every meeting started out with somebody asking, has anybody defined what the program is for which we are creating a license? Because you can't create a license without knowing what it is you want the people to do. What are the skills and knowledge you want license holders to have? And then in a teacher licensing discussion, how are those unique and separate from the skills and knowledge that you require of teachers who are currently licensed in the state of Minnesota? Is that body of knowledge and skills so unique that it is separate from existing licenses? Is it a little bit of new skills and knowledge so it might turn out to be a certificate to add to a regular license? Are there other ways of proceeding with this? But since the programmatic piece was never defined, and it's not in the Board of Teaching's authority to define instructional delivery models in our public schools, we ended up in a very frustrated place. I didn't hear from my two friends here anything about the teachers who are teaching in these programs, and I think they'd agree with me, that regular teachers in other schools don't want for their own students. Every Minnesota teacher would love to have time to be able to individualize programming for their students, to be able to work with integrating content areas rather than isolating them. That's not the way we organize, particularly right now. Interdisciplinary programs have to be clearly defined before we can create licenses that provide evidence that a teacher is prepared to work with our students in that capacity. The last thing I'd like to offer is, in our work, we heard from two national experts about interdisciplinary instruction. The comments they brought to us were not over and above the regular content areas, but were in fact were unique professional skills as well as content. As a matter of fact, we talked about the notion that a teacher might actually need more content background rather than less in order to be able to make those connections among the various content areas. We hope that teachers are all facilitators. We hope that Minnesota teachers are looking to designing programs as best they can to meet the needs of all of our students. So whether we're talking to professors at the U about their research on project-based, or Dr. James Bean, who works in Chicago at the university, on his research and publications about interdisciplinary work, or with Dee Thomas and her wonderful school about the work she does with students, when we talk about policy, it has to, one, serve the entire state, not just a few schools, and be really clear. If you're interested in a new license being created, we need to know what behaviors you expect of those people and in what settings. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Oswald, do you have any comments or testimony?
Yeah, I will keep my comments very brief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and also Fiber Education Minnesota, I just wanted to put a couple things on the record. Number one, the Attorney General has issued, an advisory opinion, dated March 2nd of 2004, to clarify some of the comments you may have heard earlier. And that is that they said, a review of the current applicable statutes and board rules leads me to the conclusion that the board does not have the authority to issue a license in pedagogy or an interdisciplinary license at this time. In order for the board to issue such type of licensure, the Minnesota legislature would have to give the board specific authority to issue such type of licensure. That's why we're here today. So it isn't that the board was asked, and they may have been asked to do it. They did not have the authority to do that, so I want to make that clear. We've talked a lot about waivers and variances, and I attempted to give this information earlier. I was not allowed to do it, but I want to make this clear. You heard the 7,000 figure, and I would ask you to clarify this with the Department of Education or the Board of Teaching. This interdisciplinary license is affected by the facts stated earlier about the variance and the waivers. In fact, if you look at the total headcount of variances, there are 1,775. The waivers, the total headcount is 469, for a total of 2,244 as compared to the 7,000. Now, I'm sure that the person testifying earlier did not intend to make it sound like there were 7,100-some people. What you need to know, though, is that some individuals, let's say in an ALC, may have five waivers or variances or whatever it be because of the different content area. So I just wanted to give you that information, and I encourage you to follow up if you would like. Then back to the interdisciplinary license. What will this look like in a district? So if in a district they're having difficulty trying to find a teacher, because of why? Because of the geographic area, because of a lack of salary, because of poor health insurance benefits, whatever it be, you could come up with an innovative program that involves interdisciplinary license because you can't get that math teacher. So maybe you have a science math integrated program. You go through the necessary processes, but do you really end up having a qualified math teacher? And do you want this person who wasn't licensed in the content area to be teaching your son or daughter or community child math? This is not about raising the standards for content area. And so this would be the first time, to our knowledge, that a license would be granted in a teaching method, not a content area. So we would urge you not to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions? If not, Representative Bissons,
Just one real quick question, Madam Chair, and I would direct this, I think, to, I'm not sure if Representative Bissons has the information, but does this meet the No Child Left Behind standards, and would it qualify this particular program? Even if we are to direct the Board of Teaching to do this, would they and could they develop a program that would meet those standards under No Child Left Behind? Those are the federal standards.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd ask if it would be your pleasure that Mr. Bittman return to the testifying table.
Yes, thank you.
Please, Madam Chair, Representative, No Child Left Behind requires that an individual have a bachelor's degree, have graduated from an approved program, and demonstrate competency. So the
state your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Daniel Bittman, Director of Licensing at the Department of Education. And so with that, an interdisciplinary license by itself would not meet highly qualified requirements. If an individual had another license, professional license, therefore had a bachelor's degree, had been through an approved program, and they passed an appropriate Praxis 2 test in that area, they could be considered to have met highly qualified requirements. And so they could meet it depending on the Praxis 2 and what that looked like.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
So if that's the case, why do we need an interdisciplinary license, Madam Chair and Mr. Bittman?
Mr. Bittman?
Madam Chair, Representative, I too took part in the Interdisciplinary Committee, and so I'm speaking as a member of that committee. It was determined at the end of that committee that the current waiver process does allow an individual to demonstrate that they are highly qualified through the house procedures for veteran teachers. I will indicate, however, that the department just received a letter from the Secretary of Education a couple days ago that indicates that states are to be submitting plans on how they will limit the use of house. And so if that takes place, that could potentially impact the alternative school, such as New Country, and would not allow or could not allow an individual to demonstrate that through House. But again, we just received the letter, and there are no plans at this time that have been drafted in accordance with that.
Thank you. Chair, can I follow up with one more question?
Representative Edmonds,
we just passed this in this bill that dealt with the praxis qualifications, you know, that we can take a test. So wouldn't that then take the...
Oh, no.
I'm so sorry. I thought I had put it on silent. I obviously hadn't, Madam Chair.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Continue.
Where was I? Oh, since we just passed a bill that says you can take a praxis test and be qualified, then I'll ask again, why do we need this interdisciplinary license?
Yes. Mr. Baker?
Madam Chair, Representative, one difficult thing regarding highly qualified would be that the interdisciplinary is not considered a core academic area, so that would need to be worked through. We would be the first state to do that if we had a license of that sort. So because those particular areas aren't identified, it would be a challenge that we would need to work through with the Department of Education.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I think Dean Thomas, you know, talked very articulately to that issue about cost and time, you know, to pick up study for, pay for, pass a praxis exam in all the areas that she works with in a kid when working with the child in a more, you know, whole child perspective. So she was very, very specific on that. You know, Madam Chair and members, I'd just like you to consider one thing. You know, is the tail wagging the dog, or should the dog be wagging the tail? All right. In other words, are we going to sit here when we know what's right to do with for children? And I'm not here bringing a bill because of a teacher shortage in X, Y, or Z. I'm not here bringing forward a bill because I think there are superintendents around the state of Minnesota who aren't going to bother finding a math teacher. They're going to go ahead and get an interdisciplinary teacher instead. Well, I think the superintendent at a local school district cares about the children a little more than that, all right? I give them a little more credit than that. I'm not here bringing forward a bill, all right, which would water down what we expect out of our teachers. In fact, if you read the bill, to get an interdisciplinary license, you have to pass an approved program developed by a secondary institution, right? A college or university. I'm not asking that they'd be cut out of the picture. I'm asking them to develop the program. Right? I'm not asking that the Board of Teaching now be mandated you must give because of whatever rules here. I'm putting in here rulemaking authority for the Board of Teaching to develop the high standards for this program. I think an interdisciplinary approach, a whole child approach, is a good way to teach some kids. Not all. Right? Some kids are doing just fine under the current program. But we have no way right now of legitimizing a more holistic nature to the education, the teaching, and the learning of our children. That's the purpose of this bill. Going through all the current steps and processes for any other teaching license, right? Not trying to short-circuit anything, just saying, you know, maybe the AG is right. Maybe the Board of Teaching doesn't have this power. You know, if they got the advisory letter in 04, it would have been nice for them to give it to us before tonight, or at least tell us about it before tonight, right? Okay, fine. I give. Uncle, let's give them the authority so they finally do this, what we've been asking for 6 years. All right. So, I hope you can support this.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, I remember... I can't see you. I remember way back in the... It's because of Representative Prinzing. She's in the way. Remember a certain middle school? We thought middle school, and I remember coming to... where you were teaching, and you had the reputation of getting up at 3:30 and you'd be there by 4:30, and in your math class you had an individualized lesson for every kid in your classes with correctives for those who needed them. And so I understand, you understand, I can see where you come from in that respect, because you were an individual program for each kid. And if you recall, in the school I was at, we had houses, and we'd have house projects, and the four core subject matters would always do projects together, and the math teacher would have the math input, and the science teacher his input or her input, and so on and so forth. And it sounds like is D. Thomas in Henderson, where my mother-in-law taught, by the way. that's just a sidebar. She's doing it at an elementary level, and I'm trying to wrap my arms around this, because the higher you get into high school, you know, all of a sudden you have an interdisciplinary teacher doing a project-based curriculum where this person might have to teach calculus or advanced physics and at the same time know a lot about biology or social study. I'm trying to wrap my arms around it, because I wouldn't qualify to be that teacher.
Representative Diskin. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, one of the beauties of this process is that you rely on the teacher's expertise and on the teacher's intelligence. And the teacher is free then to bring in community experts and free to work with their colleagues in areas where they may not have expertise. Right. That's in, you know, again, relying on a teacher's not only their knowledge of a content area, but also relying on a teacher's intelligence. And so, you know, if I'm asked to teach Shakespeare in an interdisciplinary approach, I'm probably going to be on the phone to Representative Erickson and saying, you know, you're retired, or Representative Sharon, you are an expert, right? Can you come on down and help me out with that? And making those kinds of decisions. The whole key here isn't just expanding opportunities and expanding different ways of approaching learning, acknowledging that children are indeed different, and a cookie cutter one shape fits all doesn't work anymore. And we're becoming better, we're becoming smarter. We need to, as a legislature, provide the flexibility for good people, licensed teachers who have gone through all the processes as laid out, good people, to do the right thing. We shouldn't be an impediment, we should be an encouragement.
Representative Quincy.
Oh, thank you. First thing is, I'm a little perplexed as to why this is such a bad idea, since really all of our elementary school teachers have an interdisciplinary license. And I know we can argue about the complexity of content, but sometimes I look at what an elementary school teacher has to do in terms of teaching a student about how to read, that looks pretty complex compared to in high school, where you can assign a reading and then go grade papers while the kids sit and read it. And even then, we're starting to teach reading at some points in high school now, too. There's also somewhat of a mixed message here in that when I got into teaching, we kept hearing about writing across the curriculum and integrating math into social studies and making sure we're bringing all these subjects together and not being so compartmentalized. In fact, that's what the profiles were about. So those of you who are still in love with the profiles, you'd think we'd kind of jump all over this interdisciplinary opportunity to bring the profiles back. That might turn a few of you off, but not to do that. But I guess, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say, is there's this wide spectrum, and why are we... Sorry, Representative Biskin. I, I really don't think this is a bring the profiles back any more than the fact that elementary school teachers only teach the profile learning. But I think that the interdisciplinary licensure piece and it makes sense, not just for elementary school teachers, but we also see this move to go to middle schools and having a 5th to 8th grade licensure and a 5th to 12th grade licensure. In that 5th to 8th grade time, I can see this interdisciplinary license being excellent for those teachers who are in that middle school, which is a hybrid of elementary school and the very compartmentalized high school. And to be very, there are some schools trying it already, having a hard time fitting the compartmentalized high school teacher into that middle school and trying to make, that's where some of these variances come from, I'm sure. So I think it's a great idea, and I'd hate to put more teachers in that mixed message zone of go get your compartmental license and then show up to school ready to teach interdisciplinary, because that's what professional development's going to be all about.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Representative Biskins for bringing a profile bill to the committee. Madam Chair, I guess you know, one of the questions would just be if Representative Biskins could elaborate a bit, because I think one of the issues is really just more about workability in terms of what kind of program is it that would end up being an interdisciplinary program, an institution. I am assuming would have to come up with something, and the board would have to approve it, as I understand it. And I'm not sure if that would be one program that would fit all interdisciplinary programs, or would we be looking at a number of interdisciplinary programs that would then all qualify? And I guess if I've got that part straight, the kind of the quick question is, do you have a timeline idea of when this would all occur?
Representative Isom. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad to see Ms. Patrick is still in the room and not running out to get Representative Pawlowski. If he heard I was bringing back the profile, I'd be in big trouble. The timeline and what is envisioned here, Madam Chair, I'd like to direct, or if it be your pleasure, that Commissioner Wadle speak to.
Yes, Commissioner Riedel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. First of all, to your question, you know, what kind of license, or are you talking about kind of program?
Madam Chair and Mr. Riedel, I'm just, are we thinking there would only be one program and that would cover whatever is happening in terms of this interdisciplinary delivery of education, or do you envision a number of programs that would come up because of the differences that are going on among the various schools that are using this approach?
Okay, thank you,
Commissioner Wadle,
for that clarification, Madam Chair. Certainly there would be different kinds of programs and different kind of models, but they would all end up with kids meeting the state's graduation standards. So if you could envision, right now we have, now you have your, let's just say high school, this could be middle school, but let's just say it's high school. You have, you know, your high school math program, and it's got algebra and geometry and trigonometry, you know, all the way through, and kids meet the math standards. And you have your science programs the same way. This high school would be organized around those same standards, except students would be engaged in, at one time they would be learning the science, math, maybe meeting an English standard, then a multi, across the different content standard areas. It is a very different approach, and you almost have to go look at it to see how it works, because kids don't move around from class to class to class. They are learning in their projects very, very rigorous, meeting very, very rigorous standards. It's kind of interesting. One of the students that I work with just happened to graduate from the New Country School. That individual is a sophomore at McAllister.
The last time I checked, you don't just kind of get into McAllister with a D-minus average. So these kids are learning a great deal at these types of schools, very practical, but they come out meeting the same types of graduation standards that kids in a content area would learn.
And Madam Chair, I just quickly, do you have a sense of the timeline that we'd be looking at? Because a part of the bill is then to say it's a mandate that people must have the license, and therefore at some point the people that have used this waiver and variance process as necessary to deliver the kind of education at New Country School that you're referring to would no longer be able to use that path in order to deliver the education. And I'm just wondering how that, what the vision is for all of that fitting together so that people have the license. people would have the chance to get I guess it's a high-profile issue, man. that they would be able to get the license in a timely fashion because they no longer could use waivers to teach in these schools that are using a project-based or interdisciplinary-based approach. So, I mean, are we looking at 5 years, 10 years for all of this to happen?
Commissioner Waddell.
Madam Chair, Representative, I usually would say that something of this nature would be in effect within a specific period of time of 3 to 5 years, and in the meantime, because many of these current teachers, the bill says when a current teacher goes to a college to take whatever they need to finish this license, the bill says the college must look at their current experience and training and obviously grant appropriate amounts of credit for that training and experience that they have had. So it's not like they're starting from scratch. So usually a 3-year phase-in process would be appropriate. We have to remember that it takes a while for the Board of Teachers to actually finish the license and then college programs actually be approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, to Representative Thorne's question, Representative Thorne, both you and I sit on K-12 finance, and I think you ask a good question because Representative Segrin will probably want to know when we have to pay for the rulemaking process, either this biennium or next. So it's something we should flush out as it gets to the Finance Committee.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill, like some others we saw earlier, dealing with licensing is interesting to me as not as a teacher, not as a school board member, but just as a regular parent. And I was looking into some of the licensure requirements for teachers this year because it was interesting to me and comparing to my profession and other professions. And I found it to be utterly perplexing, the process itself and the disconnect between what I see within the testing requirements and what I'm hearing in committee about the need to have highly qualified teachers and have them evenly distributed for all our classrooms. But yet we have work that we have charged with this particular study that said we need interdisciplinary teachers. That's a need, that's a requirement, that's a problem. The problem is screaming for a solution. The solution we have is this study, this task force, that produces absolutely nothing but more reasons why we can't solve the problem. I think that this is a waste of our money, and I think that the people on this board really owe us the $10,000 that was spent on this to go back and come up with a solution. And as a parent, this is just absolutely maddening to me, and it's something that I want to do is to get in. If we're totally interested in having highly qualified teachers, let's make sure that they are in the classroom, let's measure what they know, and let's give them the tests that measure that and get out instead of coming up with 55 more reasons not to do it. So, I mean, this is very upsetting to me, and just in general with this particular study in particular, but with all of the licensing bills, it's been a real learning experience for me, as there are many on this committee, or in this committee, that I learn and also enjoy very much learning from the teachers and from the school board members. But I just want to applaud Representative Biskins for his directive to finally do something and get off the dime instead of coming up with more reasons not to solve the problem.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sandler. I'd like D. Thomas to come to the table. Ms. Thomas, I've been looking at the list of task force members and also the invited expert guests and do not see you listed. Could you explain, as a former board member, why you were not included in this when I know that, you know, while you served on the board, you brought forth with Vernae Hasbarken from MREA the bill that I carried last year for the interdisciplinary innovative. I'm just puzzled why you weren't included.
Ms. Thomas.
D. Thomas, Madam Chair, Representative, I think the board had heard from me so many times and in such depth that they knew where I came from, and it was probably a repeat of what had happened. We went through this four times, I believe, on the board, trying to come up with a solution and never being able to come up with a solution and a licensure, and I'm still sitting here without a license for what I do. And so that is a concern of mine. And as this last task force got together, I think they were addressing the same things that we addressed for the last three times, trying to come up with a way to go about doing this. So I probably could have been there, but they had heard all of my concerns and stuff prior to that time.
So, Ms. Thomas,
Representative Wilson,
Representative Sandler, you're an expert in this area, yet you were not called as an expert guest. You had conversations during Board of Teaching meetings, I know that, and you said, you know, that they heard from you ad nauseum, probably. But I see nothing in the recommendations and rationale in the task force report that even suggest moving in the direction of, I think, all the information that you must have provided them while you served on the board and tried to get your fellow board members, your colleagues, to create this. So what was the stumbling block?
Ms. Thomas.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the stumbling block came in when they had the interpretation from the Attorney General's office. And there was concern over whether this was a content license or a pedagogy license. And when we spoke with Bernie, he said the Board of Teaching was unable to deliver a pedagogy-based license. And so that's kind of where we came into a stumbling block. We weren't able to move forward because the board was not able to do that. And I think that's kind of what the stumbling block was as they went through the process. And we do have a number of members of that task force here today.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Representative Biskins?
Madam Chair, are you ready for me to renew my motion?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3908 be recommended passing be referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
The motion prevails and passes on.
Representative Eastland, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File number 3800
pass and be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Representative Eastman moves House File number 3800, recommended be passed, moved to, which committee did you say?
K-12 Finance.
K-12 Finance. Go ahead with your bill, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill has nothing to do with licensure. So we can start fresh with something new. What this bill is about is it in a nutshell, it requires the department to create a registry that can voluntarily be entered into by parents putting their child's email or electronic addresses into, and it would eventually serve as a no call list, similar to a no call list. That's the concept of the bill. And what I want to do for a minute is just talk about the need for the bill. I don't know what your experience is, but as a baby boomer, I guess my life has covered quite a bit of change in the area of technology and what we have. I grew up in a rural area. I grew up on a farm. I remember the old crank telephone, and that was the way we communicated. We had 8 people on our line, and you could pick it up and listen to the neighbor talk or whatever was going on anytime you want. There was a lot of accountability that went on in that system. Actually, we had that system until I was in my high school years. We actually, we had 3 people on our line, and then finally we graduated to dial telephones and all that kind of stuff. But that's where I came from, and where we are today is, every child has a cell phone. We were all introduced to the internet back in the 90s when Al Gore invented it, and we have email now. Children have email addresses. There's a lot of anonymity. There's a lot of anonymous privacy in our culture today. And one of the things that the parents are crying out for is, how do we use this technology and still know that our kids are safe and aren't being bombarded with all kinds of information that really is harmful to them and that we don't want them to receive? And so that's really the core of where this bill comes from and why I introduced this bill. We've done some things in the past to really protect the kind of things that get to children. I don't know, I'll date myself again, but you can remember, it wasn't too long ago when Joe Camel was outlawed. We can't use him anymore because he's attractive to kids, and we don't want to bombard them with that information. When I was young, we had the Land of Sky Blue Water. Anybody remember what that commercial was?
Yeah.
We had the little bears running around on TV, watch the twins. Those were all things that were kind of a part of what I was growing up. We've recognized that there's a need to take some of those issues and exercise some judgment and say that it's not appropriate that kids be exposed to that kind of stuff. So what this bill is about is allowing parents to have a choice, allowing school districts to have a choice, to be able to have some degree of control and understanding of the kind of things that are going to their kids. Right now, I don't know, I mean, in the House, we have probably the best, I don't know if it's the best, I would hope that we have better stuff, but we have a pretty good filtering system. But I don't know how many Viagra ads you have to look at every day, and how many, other obscene things you have to look at on your internet every day, and we are doing a good job of filtering the stuff off. And if it's getting through to us, it's getting through to our kids. And so we are, I think we're in a position where we need to look and see if there's some way we could create a way to manage the technology that we're blessed to have so we can use it at the same time, protect the kind of things that our kids have to be dealing with so that we can protect the fact that they're kids. And so that's really the reason for the bill, and I'm going to have somebody that knows a lot more about how this works explain this and how it would work. This bill has been passed. A similar version of this bill has been passed in 2 other states. It is already in force in 2 other states, Michigan and Utah, so there is some experience and there is some ability to be able to look at some of the flaws that have been put into the other states, and we have the ability to learn from that. So who I have with me today is Erin Berry, and she is a person that has been involved with the company that has operated the system in Utah and Michigan, and she's going to explain a little bit about how the system works, what it does, and how it could benefit us in Minnesota as well.
Thank you. Ms. Berry, could you repeat your name for the record, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Erin Berry, and I'm with UNSAM Registry Services.
as Representative Eastland said, we run the registry service for the states of Utah and Michigan and have testified before multiple states who are also considering this type of legislation. Again, it's similar to a do not call list, but what Minnesota has done, different from Michigan and Utah, is open the registry up not just to children's email addresses, but to make it accessible to families so that any Minnesota resident can sign up if they don't want to receive inappropriate email into their inboxes, which we think is a positive step forward, because a lot of people in Utah and Michigan said, you know, I don't have children, but I don't want to receive pornographic messages, and I would like a way for my family to be protected as well. In addition, the original legislative intent was so that parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, any child that may have access to your computer could sign up, but there was confusion by just limiting it to children. So that's something that Representative Eastland has done, which we applaud. Michigan and Utah, the laws passed 2 years ago, but they had a deferred effective date. So they just recently started, and July was when Utah's went live. Michigan's went live due to a drafting error. We had to kind of go back and correct, but theirs went live in November. And thousands of parents have been signing up, and tons of schools have also been signing up as well. The great part about the list is that schools can register their entire domain so that an entire school district can say that our email addresses are off limits to pornographic materials as well. And school districts have really appreciated this step to sort of, you know, have jurisdiction over their email addresses and say that this inappropriate material is just not acceptable to send to our schools. The type of law has been on the books, you know, this sort of law has been on the books for years. In 1968, there was a Mail Preference Service Act that was done for sort of brown bag porn that was sent to your homes. You know, and they would send for free and say, you know, all you have to do is fill out this card and send it back. So this type of law, again, it's been on the books for a while, and this is just sort of bringing it into the digital age and saying it's something that we want to apply to mobile phone numbers and email addresses and also instant messenger IDs. So AOL, Yahoo, MSN, all of those are... I'm not sure. I actually have Instant Messenger, and I know that I've been contacted multiple times by some scandalous, you know, message that pops up on my screen, and I would hate for that to happen to children as well. An important point to make, of course, is that this type of registry doesn't replace good parenting. In other states, you know, they still have encouraged parents to discuss, you know, the internet with their children and make sure that they understand what safe internet is. This doesn't replace filters. Filters are still very important. But this gives the state jurisdiction over their email addresses to say that if you're going to register your email or your mobile phone with the state of Minnesota, then your email should be protected by Minnesota's laws. Without this type of a law, it's hard to sort of give an email address or, you know, jurisdiction. It doesn't have an area code. It doesn't have a zip code. It's the World Wide Web. It could be anywhere. So this sort of says, my email address will now be protected by the umbrella of Minnesota's laws. I'm welcome to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Maybe I have a few things I'd like to add. Just clarifications about the bill. The way the bill works, or the way this registry would work, is that when people would subscribe to this registry service, their name would go on the service, and then companies that were emailing to email lists would have to scrub their list against the state list and remove any names that were on there if they were sending material that was inappropriate for minors. The program is funded is that each time someone scrubs a list, they have to pay 0.1 cent for each address that they scrub. Now, what that means is, for a list of 10,000, they pay $10. For a list of 100,000, they pay $100. We're not talking about an exorbitant amount of money, even though some will lead you to believe that that's the case. But what needs to happen is they need to scrub their lists every 30 days, because they're required to honor the list, and it's good for 30 days. So people that are subscribing onto the system then would be picked up every 30 days, and it would be a growing list. I think the one thing I want to point out about this kind of an approach is that advertising to most companies that are trying to sell products to the public usually costs a lot of money. If you want to send something in the mail, you pay a lot of money to buy lists, and you pay a lot of money to produce listing material, and you pay a lot of money to mail it out. And so you do a lot of research to find out that you're sending it to only the people that you want to send it to. If you put an advertisement on TV, you pay a lot of money. If you put an advertisement on a radio, you pay a lot of money. If you put an advertisement in a magazine, you pay a lot of money. You put an advertisement on email, you pay nothing. And so what's happened here is the technology has opened up the world of everybody's personal life to anybody that wants to advertise to them directly, and they can do it for nothing. So my point is I think $100 a month for 100,000 lists is $1,200 a year is what we're asking these people to pay to keep this material from getting to our kids' email address. And I don't think that is outrageous at all when you consider what they would pay for other venues of advertising. So I think that's kind of a point that I wanted to make at the upfront. It's funded by itself, and it's funded by the use of the registry by the people that want to send to addresses in Minnesota. The registry is free, so anybody can add to the registry for no cost. So I think that's just kind of basically how the system works, and we're open to questions. And I think there are some that may want to testify here with some concerns about the bill as well. So.
Thank you. Representative Nornes?
I just had a question. Where do they... I'm not sure where my email address goes. I mean, is it out there in cyberspace for everyone to find? There is... So obviously it's not private. And that's where somebody is providing this information to these folks that are sending this junk? I don't understand that,
Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that I understand how they get their lists either. I do know that we are, as House members, all of our information is in the public domain. I mean, anybody that wants it can just look it up and get it. And I mean, and if you look on those emails we get, and you scan everybody in the House has gotten one, everybody in the Senate's gotten one. So, I mean, some email addresses I'm sure are more accessible than others, but I think eventually, as you send and use the internet, your email address begins to get broader and broader exposure, and eventually it gets on people's lists.
I just want to add one more thing, Chair.
Representative Norris.
Mr. Chair. The provider that I have back home actually does that for me for $1 a month, which is very effective. So I get very little email junk anymore. I don't know if all providers have that, but it's just an extra. I mean, it's not the final answer, but it works pretty well. So
there are good filtering systems out there. There's no question about that. I guess what we're talking about, there's a lot of stuff that's legal that really still is not appropriate for minors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're doing is drawing the line a little differently and saying that there's some of this stuff that, yeah, we may get it, and it may not be offensive to us even because it's part of an adult world, but it's not something that we think is appropriate for minors or that a parent might think is appropriate for their children to receive.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifier or Representative Beasley? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for this bill? Would anybody in the audience like to testify against this bill? Sir, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. First of all, let me just say the goal of this bill is laudable, but we think the scope is too broad, and for that reason we oppose House File 3800. The draft really raises many questions to us. For example, how does this bill interact with the anti-spam legislation that was passed a couple of sessions ago? That legislation really took months to negotiate and to fine-tune, so this bill, as it stands right now, was introduced, I believe, a week ago. I think there needs to be a lot of work and attention paid to it before it would move forward. These are complex issues, and this one is certainly similar to the anti-spam legislation in that respect. In addition, again, as I mentioned, the bill is too broad. We believe it could have some implications for legitimate business activity. For example, if a radio station were to promote a concert, and the sponsor of a concert happened to be a age-restricted product, say an alcoholic beverage, under this legislation, that could trigger the penalty section because, one, if you look on subdivision 4, the primary purpose of the message is to advertise or induce the sale of a product or service that a minor is prohibited by law from purchasing, viewing, possessing. That's on.
Could you tell us what line you're on?
Okay, that is on page 2, line 26, 27, 28. Even though some would say that the primary purpose is promoting the concert itself, advertisers attach their names to these events for reasons, and we fear that this could get caught up in the scope of this bill. Another example is there are other age-restricted activities, such as voting. We don't let minors vote. If they email, MTV is fond of having a program that encourages young people to vote. If a 17-year-old were to receive an email, that also would be caught up in this legislation. As mentioned earlier, there's also minimal experience with this legislation in other states. It's been effective for a few months, and we think we ought to take some time to see how it's working in other states before we enact it here. Another question that comes to our minds is, will an employer be liable if an employee forwards an email that might contain some adult content to somebody's email address that might have a minor that has access to that account? All of these things, I think, need to be thought of before this bill moves forward. Two other points I'd like to make. The safe harbor section, which is on page 3, starting on line 12, paragraph H. We think that might need some work, too, to exclude this type of legitimate business transactions that we think could be captured. Currently, you have to have face-to-face contact, a written consent, and so on. We think there are other ways to address some of our concerns with some safe harbors. And finally, the penalty section, subdivision 6 and 7 on page 4, certainly concern us. The subdivision 6 has provision for treble damages. Subdivision 7 has a significant civil penalties. And maybe something that we're a little curious about is on line 4.23, the sentence beginning on line 4.23, that if someone consents to having email or communication that's received from a sender, they still can be subject to the criminal and civil actions under this bill. We're not quite sure why that is the case, that if someone consents to the transaction, there really should be no criminal or civil penalties associated with this. So in summary, this is certainly a very complex and complicated issue, one that probably should be reviewed by the at least three other committees of the House Commerce Committee, the Civil Law Committee, and the Government Operations Committee, since there is rulemaking involved. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Discus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have questions of the author.
Representative Discus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, we've heard the concerns from the chamber. It's come to my attention that there are some other organizations that have concerns. Have they contacted you?
Mr. Chair. No, I did visit with the chamber folks this afternoon. If there's others that would want to speak, they certainly can.
Representative Vista.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vista, and I'm not sure that the testimony will be much different from the people I've talked to. It's probably along the same lines, so I'm not sure that's necessary. Representative Eastland, have you been made aware, as I have, that this bill probably will be rolled into other, and need to be seen by other policy committees?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Or Mr. Representative
Vista, pardon me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, what's your intention tonight?
Representative Eastland?
Mr. Chair, my intention will be to move that the bill be laid on the table.
The chair will lay the bill on the table.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Distance, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I'd like to move that House File 3783 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, bill's pretty self-explanatory. I hope you can support it.
Do you have any testimony?
Madam Chair, if I could, we have Mr. Gene Piccolo from the Minnesota Association of Chartered Schools to say about three sentences, if you would entertain that, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Piccolo.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Waiver.
My name is Eugene Piccolo. Just three brief comments. First, the Education Commission of the States has done a study that looks at the length of charters across the country. And of the 40 states in the District of Columbia that have charter school laws, 22 states do not have any specific number of years in terms of renewals. And of the 18 states in the District of Columbia that do have specific renewal years in charter contracts, only Minnesota and Arkansas have 3 years or less. 14 of those states have minimum of 5 years. Some states go as high as 15 years. And there's even one state that has contracts up to 30 years, which we do not support. Second, more importantly than what other states do, is we believe this would provide sponsors a wider latitude in setting the length of the contract and give them another tool in terms of accountability with the schools. And third and finally, we believe that this process should recognize schools that are successful and doing the job well done, and this would allow that to be done. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Greiley.
Madam Chair, that wasn't, I was motioning for something else.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Distance, what's the rationale for even less oversight over charter schools, given the difficult history and the general poor academic performance found by charter schools?
Mr. Piccolo? Representative Distance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davney, I don't believe this provides any less oversight than currently is in law. This is just the amount of time that a sponsor can contract with a chartered school. There is no reduction in oversight. There's no reduction in reporting. There's no reduction in anything. This just says, you know, if it's a good chartered school and it's a good relationship and the board has done well,
And the sponsor has done well in overseeing this chartered school, because we're not talking about failing chartered schools here. We're talking about successful chartered schools. We're talking about the sponsor relationship. The sponsor is the one who ultimately is on, name is out there for the oversight of the health of the chartered school. If they want to go up to after the first contract, if they want to go up to 5 years, we should probably allow it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Representative Biskins, I understand the intent. I just don't see any of that intent backed up with any language here. You identify that this is only for those successful charter schools, and I presume by that you mean those that are financially sound, which has been a particular area of concern and problem with charter schools, as well as academically. But in I don't see any language that defines successful charter school. And I'm going on the assumption, the hope, that when a sponsor, when a chartered, a term of charter comes up for renewal, that there's an engagement, a more intense engagement than whatever may be happening on a day-to-day level, review of financial records, review of board minutes, review of academic performance, review of the physical plan. It's more intense as the sponsor looks to reconsider the process. And so if we draw that out from an every 3 year process, that intense interaction, to an every 5 year process, then I would argue there in fact is less intense of a process and less intense of an oversight.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Pickle would like to speak to this also, but I'll just make a brief statement. Representative Daphne, I would hope that the intensive oversight that you speak to, right, is one that is happening all the time. Right, and that we're not waiting for the renewal process for this to happen. Now, Representative Daphne, I don't know if you're aware, I think you are, that I'm now working in a chartered school in downtown St. Paul, and our sponsor is the Ordway Center, and we are in constant communication. They're constantly looking at how we are doing, how the health of our school is, both a fiduciary nature and in climate and culture, how things are working. I hope that relationship is taking place at all times. I agree that it's probably human nature that it ratchets up a bit. But when I say successful chartered school, what I'm talking about is a chartered school that is operating and performing at the level of expectation. It's kind of like the successful classroom, Representative Daphne. It's the one the administrator rarely visits, all right? And you know that as a teacher. We're in the unsuccessful classrooms all the time, and they get a lot of recognition from administrators. And the same is true with chartered schools. You'll hear about those that are in trouble, and we've got a wonderful process, I think, that proves the success of the initiative started in 1992 here in Minnesota, all right? Because for the first time we have public schools that if they're not working, we can shut them down, and we do. It makes a big splash in the press, and it creates some issues, but it's a good process, and one I hope we continue with. But Madam Chair, Ms. Pickle would like to speak to the issue.
Madam Chair, Representative. Just two thoughts. One is that there is an ongoing effort to improve the relationship between sponsors and schools. The state has undertaken an initiative to put in more requirements on sponsors so that they do a better job in their role. And the schools themselves are undertaking more initiatives. We are looking at the idea of an accreditation process down the line that will also add a component to that renewal process. Madam Chair, one last question.
Representative Radney.
I guess to Mr. Pickler, then, you're telling me that there's more elaboration that's being developed.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be prudent, then, to delay this change until after that elaboration is in place and we can have some confidence that it's effective?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Danny. One of the things is this bill allows sponsors to go up to 5 years. It does not mandate a 5-year like many states. This allows a sponsor and a school to go up to 5 years. So if a school is doing the performance requirements of their charter contract, the sponsor can then give them a longer renewal. That's all this bill does.
Are there any further questions? Representative Biskin, would you care to renew your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 3783 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register.
Representative Biskin renews that his motion that House File 3783 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
It passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I would like to call Representative Latz to the testifying table. Representative Latz, would you like to move your bill?
I sure would. Madam Chair, I move that House File number 3914 be recommended to pass and be referred to K-12 Finance.
Thank you, Representative Latz. It is my impression that you have an amendment to the bill.
I do. Madam Chair, I'd like to move adoption of Amendment H3914A1 as an author's amendment. Oops,
where is that?
Been passed out, I guess.
Okay. We will give members just a moment to take a look at it. Would you like to summarize the amendment for us, please?
Yes. Well, it actually would be helpful to summarize the bill, I think, to put the amendment in context.
Really? Are you arguing with the chair?
But I will do my very best, Madam Chair, to summarize the amendment and fit it into the context of the bill.
Representative Labs, would you please summarize the bill?
Madam
Chair, just liking my new phone power.
Didn't take long to get the lighters. Madam Chair, the amendment deletes Section 1 of the bill. When the bill was originally drafted, it contained added a section to the definition of facility, and in response and in consultation with the Department of Education, we've concluded that we think there might be a simpler way to do this that would not have some secondary effects that were unintended. The amendment also amends page 8, line 4 of the bill to basically reinsert most of the stricken language and to delete a reference to the broadest compulsory education provisions in statute. With this amendment, then, the bill will not require the Department of Education to accept reports regarding and conduct investigations of allegations of maltreatment that might have occurred in religious school institutions, non-public school institutions, and homeschools. Those locations or facilities will be covered by a different provision in the bill, which is sort of a default provision that provides for the local county welfare agency to conduct investigations, as they do for just about everything right now that's not covered specifically by the Department of Education, Department of Human Services, or the Department of Health. Page 8, line 4's amendment also adds a reference to subdivision 17 to the subdivisions 9, 11, and 13. Subdivision 17 is a vocational education provision, so it makes sure that that is covered in this bill by the Department of Education's investigatory responsibilities. And then page 8, line 6, because we have, we were making cross-references to the facility definition, because we're doing this a little bit differently than originally contemplated in the draft of the bill, instead of making that reference to facility, instead we insert a longer description of specific programs that are intended to be covered by the jurisdiction of the Department of Education. And that's what is done with that amendment. Would you like me to further describe anything at this time with regard to the bill, or shall we? Whatever the chair's prerogative is, I'm happy to support.
I would like to vote on the amendment. Oh, excuse me, Representative Latz. I think you're familiar with this this amendment. And I will make the oral amendment for on page 7, line 14, after the word facility, insert or a school under subdivision 3B. Is that okay with you?
Yes, that's... that's to further clarify the language in the bill. Since we just deleted the definition of facility earlier, we needed to incorporate that cross-reference where you just did.
So that oral amendment is incorporated into your A1 amendment.
Please.
Thank you. Okay, all in favor of those, all in favor of the A1 amendment for House File 3914, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is passed. Adopted. Okay. Representative Latz, would you like to address the bill? Or have you done that adequately?
Let me set the context
briefly.
It's important to understand where this came from. And I do have a constituent that came to me in connection with an incident that occurred relating to her child. In a school facility, in a school building, a program that was a summer daycare type of program that was operated by the school district. And when she sought to report the incident and seek an investigation, what she ultimately determined was that other than the school district itself, there was no other agency that had the explicit responsibility as an independent agency to investigate the allegations. She can give you a little more detail on that. Whenever there's an allegation that happens in all sorts of different places, there's an independent agency in Minnesota that is designated the responsibility to investigate the allegations rather than have the facility or location or program where the allegations, may have taken place, investigate themselves. For good reason. We don't want people or organizations to simply investigate themselves. We need some independent oversight. Well, it turned out that in this case, the Department of Education, the Department of Human Services, and the local county welfare agency all felt that they did not have jurisdiction under the statute to investigate. And also what some of them recognized explicitly was that there was a gap, simply a gap in the statute. And there were certain programs, including the one that my constituent's child was enrolled in, that simply fell through the gap. So this bill is designed to close the loop or fill the gap so that all of the programs where these kind of things might occur will at least have some designated agency to investigate. And it's before this committee in particular because most of the programs that were in the gap can be related or are related or occur in school buildings or school facilities or are operated by school districts or have some connection to schools. So that's why we're here. It also provides a backup in cases where it would not be covered by the Department of Education for investigation. It specifically designates the local county welfare agency, Child Protection,
as the responsible agency for investigating. So no one should go without some independent investigation now if an allegation occurs.
Representative Latz, did you have anybody who would like to testify in favor of the bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask Natalie Valentino to come forward. She resides in my district and is the person whose experience led to the creation of this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Valentino, would you state your name for the record, please?
I would. My name is Natalie Valentino. Madam Chair and Representatives, thank you for listening to my story about why we are here to close the gap, not just mind the gap. My five-and-a-half-year-old son was sexually attacked in a school-age care program. This happened in the morning during the summer, 7/27/05, July 27th, in the inside of a building. He was held down by two other children with a pillow over his face and sexually attacked, while teachers sat in the corner playing cards with other children. And, of course, you know, this is my child. It was very horrifying. But what we are here to talk about is how to correct this. And what Ron thought would be helpful is to talk about the process. No incident report was ever provided or any written account by the school. Despite repeated calls to them after this incident was reported to us by our son, we didn't hear anything from the school until approximately 3 o'clock the day after. Of course, we kept our child home. The manager of the 7 school-age care programs for the Hopkins School District, including the Meadowbrook location, when I was talking with her, trying to understand what is the process that you will follow to not only investigate this incident with our child, but also to protect the other children that were there, she didn't have any description of what they were going to be following. And I was very concerned. I called her back the next day. She said she would consult with her boss. She said, but my boss doesn't work on Fridays. You know, it's the summer. So I called back, and she really wasn't able to give me any procedure or action plan. I told her I was very concerned. My child was one of two children that day that were attacked by one of the two children. There was a boy and a girl. And a second child was attacked in the bathroom, and he molested another child. And I kept saying to them, what is your plan to protect the children that are there? There was no plan. Finally, on the and I asked her, what is your maltreatment procedure for this SAC? She said, we don't have one. I asked her then to give me the district's. I said, surely you have a maltreatment procedure for the district. She said, I'm not aware of it. And she managed 7 SAC programs. 5 days, finally, later, calling, I did hear from an administrator, the director of community education, and I met with her. She was very apologetic. I asked her what her plan was. They didn't have a plan. This is now 5 days after the incident. Of course, our child is at home. In the meanwhile, I contacted Child Protection immediately the next day. Child Protection told me they could not investigate this case. And they told me that they did not have jurisdiction, that the Department of Human Services must be the one to investigate. They would be referring it. I called the Department of Human Services. They told me they did not have jurisdiction over this case. This must be a case that had jurisdiction through the Department of Education. They had what was called a maltreatment unit that would be doing the investigation, they assured me. In the meanwhile, I was becoming quite frustrated, as you can well imagine. I'm sure you all have, many of you have children. And so I then called the police. Because I was just looking for someone to start the process, and also I was very concerned about the other children in the program. We knew that 2 children had been molested, and this was reported to me by a teacher that evening when I went to pick up my child, not just my child. What then happened was the Department of Education, the maltreatment investigation, said they were very, very sorry that they could not handle this case. They had other cases that were very similar. They had no jurisdiction. And they sent me a letter Actually, I think they faxed it to me, and it said that there, under the law, there were four types of programs that were exempt from jurisdiction or investigation by any, for any maltreatment in the state of Minnesota. School-age care, Head Start that is administered by a school district, any day treatment program, and community ed. So if your child was at an ECFE program, an early childhood family education, and something happened, there would be no recourse and no investigation. Desperate, I started asking people I know to try to help me about who I could call to get some help. Thankfully, someone suggested, actually I believe it was the woman at the Department of Education, she said if I were you, I would call Minnesota Licensing Board of School Administrators and see if they could help you. Thank goodness I got in touch with the executive director. He was very helpful to me. Explained what the typical process would be. He himself had 30 years involved in school administration. He knew exactly what should be done. I knew some of the things that should be done as well because I have been a child protection worker and have been a licensed social worker working specifically in child protection for 15 years. It was just a fluke that, of course, you know, this happened to my child, but that I had this knowledge. So Mr. Velke was very, very helpful. I was trying to work with the school and asked them to please have a meeting with me. Finally, on the fifth day, we did have a meeting. I asked for a neutral investigation. Would they please cooperate with a neutral investigation? And they were very sympathetic and said that they would consider it. I asked them to consider Mr. Velke's remarks, and he had suggested that he recommended that the parents be notified of the abuse immediately and that the program be shut down immediately until a proper investigation could occur. They said they would in no way cooperate with that. From somebody from their own profession, I thought this was really quite curious, but also quite disturbing. They then said that they would get back to me. And a couple days later, by email, they wrote to me and said that they would be going forward with an investigation by a consultant who they had worked with previously, and she would do an investigation. And this is what occurred. She investigated it, and I will tell you what she concluded. Repeatedly, I asked that our child be interviewed or that we be involved in the process with the police. I just kept asking, doesn't anyone care about what my child has to say about what happened to him? No one seemed to be interested. What they concluded, this was by an independent, they kept using the word independent consultant, but this woman has had an ongoing relationship with the Hopkins District for quite some time. We believe that the staff provided adequate supervision at all times and followed appropriate procedures of promptly reporting the incident to Natalie Valentino, other families, and supervisory staff. They then went on to say that she definitely believes some sexual touching occurred. Never was there ever used the term sexual attack, and no mention was ever made of the other child. That the teacher had reported to me had been molested in the bathroom. Of course, the ramifications, you may guess. Our child has had to be in therapy. We sought a separate psychiatric evaluation. He has post-traumatic stress symptoms. Thank goodness, not the full. And he is in therapy. He's had physical problems. He's had school refusal. You can imagine some of the issues. And also now, recently, we've had some physical aggression against other children. This has been an incredible thing for our family to go through. And I really encourage you all to please consider voting for this to close this incredible gap. Most people that I talked with, and I have had a lot of support around this, to connect with Senator Jane Ranum, who's been actually a co-worker, and also Representative Latz, to get this going. But what is so incredible is, as a professional who has worked in this field for years and talking with many people, whether it be Judge Alan Oleski, who many of you in this room I'm sure know was the head judge of the juvenile court in Hennepin County for years, whether it be Susan Fitzionis, a noted expert, the Child Abuse Prevention of Minnesota, the Children's Law Center, nobody knew about this gap. Most people believe that if your child walks down the hall from a classroom and goes to an SAC, a school-aged care, the same set of laws and protections are going to be there. And it isn't. So please, everyone is under the assumption that we already have these protections. And I would really sincerely ask for the prevention of thousands of our children and protection that you please vote this in. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Valentino. I think we have some questions from Representative. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Latz, my question, I guess, has to do with if an investigation is initiated, at what point does that become public? Is this a private or public investigation? I mean, I'm just concerned about whoever is involved that it can have some pretty serious ramifications just because of the publicity prior to being, you know, having a conclusion in the investigation. So I'm just wondering if this is addressed anywhere.
Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, this bill does not make any changes with regard to existing law in connection with that. As I understand existing law, it does not become public. It's a private matter.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Flats, you mentioned earlier talking to the department. Do they have a position on this bill?
Representative Latz.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, I have been in extensive conversations with the department. Amy Roberts is here from the Department of Education. She can speak for them.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Madam Chair and members, Amy Roberts with the Department of Education. The department's male treatment unit is a very small unit. We have three investigators currently who cover the state, and that is for what our current jurisdiction is as it currently is. This particular bill and amendment will have some type of fiscal impact. We're currently working on the fiscal note. I don't have the numbers. We're trying to pull together what the how many programs we're talking about and come up with some formula for how many reports we think that would result in there for how many additional staff we think we would need. There is a gap in the statute as it currently exists, and there are numerous questions of jurisdiction that come up very, very frequently, and we struggle with the statute as it currently exists in trying to determine whether or not the department can assert jurisdiction in a particular instance. Obviously, there is a liability question for us if we were to assert jurisdiction somewhere where we don't have it. And we face challenges, not frequently, but there are challenges to our authority on a number of cases. And we initially and continue to find there are a number of jurisdictions that are not aware of their requirement to report to the department. In instances of maltreatment on school grounds or in school facilities.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Roberts, I understand the confusion, and that's the purpose for the bill in front of us. My question is, putting the funding issue aside, and that's why the bill is going to K-12 finance, on the policy, are you opposed to the policy that's in this bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, I want to thank Representative Latz for working with us in amending, working on this amendment. To the extent that the amendment clarifies in a way that the original language did not, where jurisdiction lines would be drawn, the bill as amended is much easier for us to implement.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, Ms. Roberts, does the department support or oppose, or are they neutral? One, two, or three?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the department supports the policy of the bill.
Thank you.
Members, any further questions forwarded? Representative Sikora.
I'll save it. Thank you.
Any further questions? Then, Representative Latz, would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I renew my motion to House File 3914 be recommended to pass and be referred to K-12 Finance. As amended.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion is approved.
Thank you.
Okay, members, before we adjourn tonight, Representative Viscons has a couple of announcements that I'm sure we all are anxious to hear.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, we'll be meeting on Thursday. We have one bill on the docket. It's Representative Neslow's bill. And just one, members of the minority and majority, we should be looking for an amendment, another amendment that's being worked on, and hopefully will be in your possession by tomorrow.
Okay, done? Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.